1 second. Hi, everybody. We're live.
All right. Let me start by saying I'm a little congested, nasally, whatever. It's not because Marco screwed up the edit or anything like that. I'm just ever so slightly under the weather. It's fine. However, I will redeem myself by telling you two, and all of you who are listening, I have found the best website on the internet.
Oh. Is this better than Million Dollar Homepage?
Yes. Especially because I didn't earn $1 million from it.
I think of all the various internet clever things, what an amazing winner that site was.
God, yes.
Because it's the kind of thing it only works once. And yep. And even if it could work another time, it wouldn't be cool if somebody did it again. It only works once. It only works for the first person to try it. And what a fun, weird idea that was.
Yeah, so for those that aren't familiar, what this was, and jump in and interrupt me when you're ready, but it was each pixel or something like that was $1, and there were a million pixels on the homepage, so you could buy any number of pixels at $1 a piece, and over the entire million pixels on the homepage, that's $1 million, and it's still at milliondollarhomepage.com. Mm-hmm. Incredibly good idea, and I'm really impressed by it. But
you said, it's so tiny on my big monitor now, modern monitor.
Well, it's not that modern. We'll talk about that.
Glorious, I found the best 1 megapixel image.
I found the best website on the internet. Before we started recording, I asked both the boys what model year their cars were. And I asked because I was looking at, what is the URL? Autocatalogarchive.com. So if you look in the chat, and I'll put it in the show notes, there, John, is the official brochure for the 2014 Honda Accord. And because it's my favorite of all of Marco's cars, the 2013 BMW M5. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the M5 catalog is the international one, whereas the Accord catalog, or brochure, if you will, is the American one.
I don't think you posted mine, but what I want to say is 1992 Civic. That's what I want to see. I'll look that
up. All right. Well, the problem with this website, even though it is the best website on the internet, it is also the slowest website on the internet. Autocatalogarchive.com. It is incredible. And so you can look up all different, all the different marks. Is it Marquise? Marks? How do you pronounce it? Marques.
MKB.
You could just say makes. In this country, we say make and model.
That's true. But anyways, very, very good stuff. It is impossibly slow and impossibly disorganized, and yet this is my new favorite website on the internet. Incredibly good stuff.
I do miss that car. It was so loud, but it was so good.
It was so loud. It was so incredible, though. So yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes to your Accord into the BMW M5, to the brochures for that. But I've been digging up brochures for all of my old cars, including all of Aaron's old cars. I think I've gotten every single one of them. No, not my 300ZX. They didn't have my 1991 300ZX, although I think the brochure was identical. For the 1995 one that they did have. So, beggars can't be choosers, but this is really good stuff. Some of them are, first generation, if you will, first party PDF. Some of them are really good scans. Some of them are not so good scans. But regardless, very, very good stuff. My new favorite website on the internet.
I will eventually find my Nissan Maxima, but it's a very slow website.
It is hilariously slow, impossibly slow, and yet delightful. All right, we have a lot to do. We are going to do the unthinkable that we do every time there's an Apple event, an issue follow-up, and we're going to jump straight into topics. John, how are we going to cover this? It's been a busy week.
Yeah, I'll give a brief preamble, which would have been our pre-show if Casey didn't have one. I can't remember a time when we've had this many products released in this short a period of time. I know it wasn't just one event. It was 3 days worth of press releases, yada, yada. And I know what they announced was there's no new product category. They're not transitioning chip architectures. Significance-wise, it's not it's the, iPad or the Vision Pro or the Apple Watch or something. But boy, is it a lot of products in a short period of time. And the only real hitch to the schedules that the M5 Pro and Max laptops essentially got delayed until spring when they normally would have been back then. But still, even not accounting for those, this is a lot of products in a short period of time. So that's why, even though this is not a quote unquote Apple event, even though there was an Apple experience, no follow up. And this is just a lot of stuff to cover, a lot of goodies all at one time.
Yep, very much so. So you have in here, John, iPad A18 DNF.
Did not finish, yeah. Of all the rumored items, because obviously I have like the bullet points for all these items and based on the rumors, that was the only one that didn't show up, which is also rare. Normally, like, there's rumors of like four or five things, but like we know that the top three are the ones that are definitely going to be there, and then maybe a fourth or something, and usually the fourth doesn't show up. This time, they all showed up except for the new, presumably A18-powered plain old iPad, but that's a boring product anyway, so nobody cares.
All right, so the first real thing that we're going to talk about is the M4 iPad Air. Tell me about this one, John.
It's just, they stuck an M4 on the iPad Air. It's always interesting to see how they save money on these when they put them in the lesser product. So it's got an M4, but it's, you know, it's binned, as they say, in a particular way. So you can get it with an 8-core CPU, which is 3 P-cores and 5 E-cores. And yes, we're going to talk about those later. But a full M4 is 4 P-cores and 6 E-cores. So it's down 1 P and it's down 1 E to save money. the GPU is missing a core. It's 9-core instead of 10. And the RAM is 12 gigs, which is an increase over the iPad Air, which only had 8 gigs. So that's nice.
You get the iPad Air M3.
iPad Air M3. You get the N1 and the C1X, which is really nice. Apple's latest chips, you know, for Wi-Fi and stuff. So you get Wi-Fi 7, you get Bluetooth 6. That's cool. It's same size as the iPad Air M3, but a little bit heavier. And storage is no change. You could go from 128 up to a terabyte. Same colors. Environmental impact statements. I diffed them for this particular thing because, like, they say the same stuff all the time. But I'm like, well, what new stuff are you doing from the environment? Or have there been any regressions? So just like the iPad Air M3 is 30% recycled content, 100% recycled aluminum in the enclosure and recycled cobalt in the battery. And the new thing that they've been touting for all their products, and you'll hear it for each one, is manufactured with X percent renewable energy. And the iPad Air M4 is 40% renewable energy, which is nice, I guess. I mean, in the past, they would say, we try to use renewable energy, but now they're putting a number on it. So it shows that they're tracking it. So good job, Apple. Keep ratcheting that stuff up. And the pricing is unchanged and not particularly interesting. Comes in 11 and 13-inch. Cellular is $150 extra. Pre-order March 4th. Available March 12th. You know, like, it's not an exciting product, but as we always say every time there's a speed bump, speed bumps are not particularly exciting, but it's so much better than not having them. By all means, speed bump every product. If you don't have a big redesign, just put new stuff in it. And this is, I think, is an ideal speed bump. The M number went up from 3 to 4. It got the N1 and the C1X, so it's got the latest modem chip and the latest Wi-Fi chip, the latest Wi-Fi standard, the latest Bluetooth standard in Apple's lines, if not in the entire world, right? Thumbs up. Good speed bump.
Yeah, I think the iPad Air is one of those products in Apple's lineup, kind of like the like base M chip 14-inch MacBook Pro, which I have, but it's one of those items that, like, it's a mid-range product that we talk about maybe once a year when they update it, and we never think about it again. We never talk about it again, but people out there buy it, and it's fine. And it's not like, it isn't the most exciting model in any direction in particular. It's like right down the middle, and it's fine. And a lot of people out there buy it and are happy with it. You know, just like me and my 14-inch MacBook Pro, like, a lot of people are perfectly fine with this model. It doesn't have the best of everything. It doesn't have the worst or the best of anything. It doesn't have the worst of anything. The only thing that I wish they would break down one barrier on the low-end iPads, it's Face ID. Like, I recently got a recent iPad Mini for some testing, and it's Touch ID, of course, because all iPad Minis to date have been Touch ID. And it is... So it's brutal. Like, once you're used to Face ID on the iPad Pro, and the iPad Pro is so expensive and has been pushed so high up the line, Face ID, I think, should be table stakes for all iPhones and iPads. And it is for most of them, except mid-range and low-end iPads now. And I think that's the one thing that they push you to pro for that I wish they wouldn't. With that exception,
we have to wait for the next redesign. Right, because this is not really a redesign. Maybe? This is just an internal bump, but yeah.
But maybe, like, I we'll see. Like, there's rumors of the next iPad Mini going a little bit higher end with OLED. You know, we'll see. Like, maybe as OLED trickles down through the line, maybe they'll use that opportunity to do it.
As they get the smaller Face ID things, like, it might take a while, I think, because there's rumors of smaller Face ID stuff in the upcoming iPhones, but that smaller Face ID stuff is probably going to be exclusive to the high-end iPhones for a while, so I think you might have to wait two generations. We'll see.
Maybe.
Talk about being stingy about Face ID. When are we going to get a Mac with it? So get in line,
well, but,
I guess.
But at least, like, on the Mac and on the iPhone, Touch ID was like how it always was for so long. And so iPhones, I feel like, you know, on an iPhone, Touch ID was not punitive because the way you hold the phone, your thumb is already there and you were already using the home button on those models constantly. So your thumb is already there. On the Mac, the Touch ID button is on the keyboard, right where your hands already are. It's really easy to go hit it all the time. On the iPad, though, in my experience so far using this iPad mini, Touch ID is a pain in the butt because you're never already on it. You always have to like reach around for it. And it is very disruptive to the experience and it feels very clunky and punitive. It's because like when they went from home button iPads, well, again, your hand was already there all the time. When they went from the home button iPad to Touch ID iPads, it was not a step forward. It was just like, we're going to take this thing that you need to do a lot and we're going to make it worse. Because on the high-end model, we made it better with Face ID. On these low-end models, we don't want to do that. So I wish they would change that. That's the one thing about the non-pro iPads that feels punitive. And every time there's an update to the Air or the Mini or the base model, I hope for that. But so far, they have yet to deliver that. We'll see.
Next up, we have the iPhone 17e, the 17e. And this definitely is fulfilling the promise of the 16e, which is that it would get updated every year, which is exciting. And they have fixed the one major complaint that most of us had from the 16e, which is that it actually has MagSafe this year, which is very exciting.
That was the one big fumble in the 16e. I couldn't believe they did it. They corrected it immediately. So I'm excited that the 17e exists. And I'm excited that it has MagSafe because that really went from a product that I felt like I couldn't recommend to people because I just felt like you're spending so much money for this phone. It's not that cheap. Get one with MagSafe. It opens up this whole world of peripherals and sticking it to magnetic things on your dashboard and all sorts of other, you know, pops, magnetic pop sockets and holders for cards and all sorts of other great stuff. And it just seemed a shame they didn't have it and they fixed it. So good job, Apple.
Yeah, the 17e is one of these models that like, we are talking about it now. We will probably never talk about it again, but it serves an important role in the lineup, and they have done, seemingly, by all accounts, a pretty good job this time. You know, the 16e, even the 16e seemed pretty good for what it was, but we all said, except MagSafe. And yeah, now they've fixed that, so good for them. This seems like, you know, a nice model that, you know, those of us like who tend to buy the higher end phones, we'll see it in the store. We'll pick it up and be like, "Ooh, this is really small and light and simple. This is kind of fun." We won't buy it, of course.
Kind of.
Right. Yeah, sort of. Yeah. Like we won't be the ones buying it, but a lot of people will. That being said, if you are in this budget category or, you know, shopping at this like price level, if you can at all go to the $799 base model 17, is that the 79? It's $200 more. So if you can go $200 more to go from the 17e to the base model 17, you do get a lot of upgrades for that. So it is kind of worth considering, especially in the area of the screen. You get promotion, you get always on, which like that does dramatically change how people use a phone. So if the screen is important to you, the regular base model 17 is not that much more than this, and so that might be worth it. But otherwise, like, if you just want the absolute cheapest iPhone of like a new generation, this is a really solid option. And I do like that they're updating it every year seemingly now. That's going to be really nice for them and for people who buy these phones.
Yeah, and we would be talking about it. It's like, and we won't talk about it again. You know why we would talk about it again? If they didn't update it for like 3 years. Because
yeah,
they would be like, when are they ever going to update the, like, remember the SE would just sit there forever? And we would talk about it because you would say, what the hell? Like, are you making this phone or are you not? And, you know, this, I feel like putting the number in it and they fulfilled the promise so far of like, we will update this phone. We will put better stuff in it. We will correct our mistakes quickly instead of like, oh, we made an SE, but the feature set isn't quite right. I'll see you in 3 years when we try to fix it. So that's great. It does have an A19 in it with no cores disabled, which is cool. The GPU is 4-core instead of 6, which would be full, so they're saving a lot on the GPUs there. It gets the C1X modem, but it does not get the N1, which is interesting. It just has Wi-Fi 6, not even 6E, and it has Bluetooth 5.3. They do mention stuff about, in their comparison list of features, like next-generation portraits with focus and depth control. I think that's just a software change, because it's as compared to the 16e, which said portrait mode with depth control. But this says next-generation portraits, which I think it's a software thing, but I'm not entirely sure. It might be A19-powered with, like, the image processor. Speaking of screens, this does have the Ceramic Shield 2 front durability thing, which does, I think, make a difference in scratching. So it's good that it gets that, even if the screen itself is not much better. It charges faster than the 16E. They say 50% in around 30 minutes. There's no more 128 gig option. It starts at 256, so thank goodness for that. It's about the same. It is exactly the same size as 16E and weighs 2 grams more. Comes in black and white and a new color, soft pink, which, you know, black and white are boring, but straight up the middle. It's nice that it comes in one color that is not black and white. I hope they rotate that color, because the pink looks fine. It looks good, but maybe you do a blue next year, or a red, or a green. That's, again, with the lowest end, you know, bargain basement phone, you're not going to get that many options, but it's good to see one more. Environmental stuff, 30% recycled content, 85% recycled aluminum, 100% recycled cobalt in the battery, and the new thing for this year, 55% renewable energy, manufactured with 55% renewable electricity on it, not renewable energy. That's across their whole supply chain, so they say. Price is $599 for 256, which was the same price as the 16E128. So they got rid of the 128, but actually are selling the 256 the same price they sold the 128, which is nice, because sometimes they get rid of the low-end config, but they just sell the higher-end config at the higher price. And then the 512 gig is $100 less than the 512 gig 16E was. Again, pre-order March 4th, available March 11th. Pretty good update to the e-phone.
All right, this is the point in which I, as the kids say, crash out a little bit. New displays. And actually, I think all three of us will be crashing out for different reasons, come to think of it. But Apple has released two new displays. They have the Studio Display, which is basically the same as the one that I'm looking at right now. It has a better center stage camera, quote, now with improved image quality and support for desk view. Cool. Also, apparently better audio, particularly 30% deeper bass. It is moved up to Thunderbolt 5, so that can be up to 120 gigabits per second, including one upstream Thunderbolt 5 port for the host with 96-watt charging for that host, and then one downstream Thunderbolt 5 port for connecting high-speed accessories or, fascinatingly, daisy-chaining additional displays. Very cool stuff. Then there's also two USB-C ports, and we'll be talking more about the distinction between USB-C and Thunderbolt ports later. The SoC in this is the A19, which is different than the A13, and we'll be talking about the A19 later. It is still $1,600 with standard glass. It's $2,000 when you get the height-adjustable stand, or $1,900 with nanotexture, which that's a $300 delta, and thus $2,300 with a height-adjustable stand.
$400 for the height-adjustable stand is really hurting. Yeah, this is... we had a good throwback snarky toot from Jack Wellborn that used our bluish new banner on an angle. It used to actually be the logo for the show. It was the fave icon for ATP.fm website a long time. Early on in ATP, we all attended a WWDC where they updated the Mac Pro with a Mac Pro that they said was new, but it wasn't really new. I forget what they did to
it. They raised the minimum spec to a higher tier.
They got rid of the low-end model.
Yeah.
And tried to spin it as
Intel got rid of the processor.
Yeah, here's a new Mac Pro. We're like, that's not a new Mac Pro. Well, this... the Snark is less, less powerful now that we know that it comes with the A19, because it's not literally the same.
Yeah, they actually changed the hardware. They didn't change it a lot, but they did change the hardware.
They didn't change the screen part of the hardware. And when you're talking about displays, the screen part of the hardware is a really important part. Now, I'm not complaining. Like, by all means, it's under update to Thunderbolt 5, put an A19 in it for whatever that does, right? That's good. Daisy chaining is a cool feature. But the bottom line is, this is like exactly the same specs as the old Studio Display, which I believe was from 2022. It's an old display.
Yes.
It's 600 nits. It's 60 hertz. It's exactly the same resolution. It's exactly the same size. It is exactly the same price, which is insane because the price did not make any sense. That's what we've been harping on for the past, you know, several years. Like, here are the specs. It's a nice display. But $1,600 without a height-adjustable stand and $400 to add the height-adjustable stand, those numbers do not make sense for these specs. And they didn't change the screen specs, the thing you look at with your eyeball. So it's an extremely frustrating product. Now, I think they should still make this product, and I'm sad that the price hasn't changed, and good luck for them selling it in an increasingly competitive market where there are many, many options with similar or better specs for way less money, even if they come in cases that don't quite look as nice. But this product, like, if they had changed the price, I would have been fine with this. But keeping the price the same is just a it's like a finger in the eye, or I don't know what the right disrespectful expression is, but it is disrespectful. And I they did update the internals that has an A19s Thunderbolt 5, but like not changing the screen is just very upsetting to me. So this, I continue to not be enthusiastic about the base model studio display.
Yeah, I just kind of I wonder, like, who is this product for besides Casey? But like otherwise, like,
oh, hold on a second.
Like who? Because it seems like if you want a nice monitor that is not the best monitor you can get, there are so many better options that, like, in the world of PC monitors now. I mean, I guess we still often have, like, lack of integration with Apple's features,
and their cases aren't as nice or whatever.
Yeah,
like, but the price. I just feel like you can't keep the same price without changing the screen part of the monitor. It's just it's insulting.
You can if you're Apple.
Yeah, but we'll see how they sell. Like I feel like they very often travel with their displays in a Mac Pro like trajectory where they make bad product decisions and say, well, see, look, no one's buying it. It's like, but what are you doing? Like, you're not like. It's not like, as we'll see in a second, it's not like there aren't ways to continue charging ridiculous margins on monitors. You just got to make a really fancy, really nice one, and then, you get your margins. But, like, trying to be like as someone pointed out, I forget who it was, I'm sorry, but, like, someone was saying, it's just such a shame that Apple does not make any basic monitors. As we'll see when we discuss later products, Apple is getting better at making just the basic version of a lot of its products. But monitors, it's like, no, there's no such thing as a basic monitor from Apple. You have to buy it from a third party. And that's terrible. Like, there should, yes, by all means, make these fancy monitors, right? But there should be, Studio Display Neo. You know what I mean? Like, there should be a basic monitor for people who just wanted a monitor. Why won't you sell it to them, Apple? Yes, the margins will be a little bit lower, but like, anyway, this thing is a dud.
So I just want to point out the first minor update to the Retina iMac was the late 2015 model. So this was, about 10 years ago, 10 and a half years ago. That panel in the late 2015 27-inch Retina iMac was a 27-inch 5K P3 wide color 500 nit panel. That was 10 and a half years ago. Now, John, remind me, what are the specs on this? Was it 600 nits?
600 nits,
Is that the only significant difference?
I would guess so. Maybe the viewing angle is a little better. Maybe the image retention isn't quite, but it's ridiculous.
So, yeah, it just tells you, like, this is not cutting-edge technology.
Oh, and this monitor has a faster CPU than that iMac.
Fair. Maybe in single-threaded tests. That is worth pointing out, that, like, at this incredibly premium price point, what you are getting is a very, very, very similar panel and monitor and general image quality and specs to the 10.5-year-old iMac panel. I think it's a little weird to not be pushing this a little further. At least to not be lowering the price.
If they had made this the basic panel and lowered it to $999 or something like that, we'd all been singing its praises. We'd be like, finally, if you just want a basic monitor, you have a Mac laptop, you want to get an Apple monitor to match it, you don't care about fancy specs, this is the one for you. But they did not change the price. Apple does not sell any basic monitors.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in support of them revving it. I think, generally speaking, I'm not actually that disappointed with this when you ignore the price tag. But I concur with both of you, particularly John, that once you look at the price tag, it's like, come on. Really? Really? You can't lower it any? And the nanotexture is still hundreds of dollars. The tilt adjustable or height adjustable stand, rather, is hundreds of dollars. Like, really? But if you're Apple, you can do it.
Yep.
But then it's okay because you two have a positively ancient monitor sitting in front of you, and there's a new version, and it's better than ever-ish.
There's not a new version. That's the thing. Like, so our monitors, the Pro Display XDRs, have been killed. They're discontinued. They are gone. Apple has released a new monitor that is an expensive desktop monitor with XDR in the name, but it is not a replacement for the Pro Display XDR, because the Pro Display XDR is a 6K 30-inch, 32-inch monitor.
32-inch.
Yeah. And they did not release a 6K 32-inch monitor today. They killed their 6K 32-inch monitor and replaced it with a better 27-inch 5K monitor. Oh, what were the resolution and screen size of that 10.5-year-old iMac? Oh, that's right, 27-inch 5K.
It's weird because now that there's so many more third-party 6K monitors, like Apple was kind of first to the party with like a big fancy 6K monitor, and eventually third parties started releasing them too, and Apple's like, you know what, never mind.
Yeah,
27-inch.
It's very sad. Like, cause, you know, Apple has gone in and out of making very large monitors over their history, and they've always been really good. And like when there's a span where Apple's not making the biggest monitor size, everyone's kind of like, oh, I guess I'll get the third party one. But oh man, what they did release with this, you know, XDR 27-inch looks pretty good for a 27-inch monitor, but. Once you are accustomed to a certain lifestyle, it's really hard to go back.
It serves you right.
It is hard to go back real estate wise. Like that's the whole thing with monitor sizes. Like in general, the trend across the entire industry, including Apple's product lines, to be honest, has mostly been upward. Like Apple did make the 30-inch non-retina cinema display. And then there was a while in the wilderness where they didn't make anything that big again, but then eventually they came back with a 32. So maybe we're going through that cycle. Let me find the language. I think, what did they say? That like, I think they said something to the effect of the Studio Display XDR replaces the Pro Display XDR. So it's not like, oh, we're just surmising this because they stopped selling the Pro Display XDR, which they have. They stopped selling it. But they literally said the Studio Display XDR replaces the Pro Display XDR. So if you read that, you're like, oh, well, that's a clear signal that they're not going to come out with the rumored Pro Display XDR successor.
Right.
I would mostly agree that that is like, if I had to put money on something, that's what I would put it on. But if Apple was going to come out with a Pro Display XDR successor in a year or at WWDC in the summer, they would say the exact same damn thing. They would say the Studio Display XDR replaces Pro, because it does. It does replace it. They stopped selling the Pro Display XDR. They started selling Studio Display. It replaces it. And then, you know, WWDC comes along and they're like, ah, Pro Display XDR too. You know, that did replace it, but now here's this. They're never going to say like, oh, don't save your money because we might introduce a new bigger one. So my fingers are still crossed. You know, keep hope alive, yada, yada. There were rumors of a Pro Display XDR successor. This one is not called Pro Display XDR. It's called Studio Display XDR. So the name is still available. But right now, this replaces it. Maybe you can find used ones cheap or increasingly cheap. But like, as we'll get to in a second with the specs on this, the Pro Display XDR is starting to become the like, oh, I don't care about image quality. I just want a lot of pixels. You know, because as the image quality improves across the entire industry, the Pro Display XDR specs look less impressive, but the number of pixels you get stays just as impressive because there's a lot of them and the screen is big. So I'm glad I've still got my monitor. I hope it never breaks. I would not want to replace it with one of these, despite the fact that it has better picture quality in a lot of ways.
Righto. So the Studio Display XDR, as you guys said, 5K, 27-inch, same resolution. There is mini LED for the backlight with 2,304 dimming zones. John, do you happen to remember if that's more or less or otherwise?
Pro Display XDR has 576 or something. 2,300 dimming zones is pretty good. It's not the best in the world, but it's pretty, pretty good.
It's also more dense because it's a significantly smaller monitor.
Yes, exactly right.
So much sadness for Marco. There is up to 1,000 nits brightness in SDR and 2,000 nits peak brightness in HDR.
Those are big numbers, by the way, because first of all, you do not want to, well, maybe Marco does, but most people don't want to blind themselves, would want to put it at 1,000 nits SDR. That means like your white windows would be 1,000 nits. That's, unless it's a really sunny room, that's very bright. And 2,000 nits peak is higher than the XDR because the XDR was 1,600 nits peak.
Mm-hmm.
So good specs.
And most importantly, I would argue, is that this is Apple's first entry, as far as I'm aware, is a 120-hertz external display. There have been 120-hertz internal displays, but this is the first time we've seen it on the outside. And we've been theorizing that this was coming. We had heard some rumors that maybe 90 hertz would be the peak. But no, apparently 120-hertz refresh rate and adaptive sync, which allows it to vary the refresh rate between 47 hertz and all the way up to, of course, 120 hertz.
That's great. This is what we
peaked,
wanted.
This is what peaked my interest. This is what's making me wonder, should I buy one of these? Because even though I don't need 120 hertz, I certainly don't need mini LED. I don't need all that brightness, but I kind of want it.
This is a better monitor than the Studio Display, as the name would imply. It is a better monitor specs-wise than the Pro Display XDR. It's just not as big.
I had never tasted the forbidden fruit of 6K, I would be tempted by this monitor. Unfortunately, I have, and so I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the thing, right? But the color reproduction, it has Adobe RGB color gamut support in addition to P3 wide color, and both of them are available from the same default preset.
But that's nice, so you don't have to like switch modes. I mean, I guess that's just standard, but they called it out specifically, so I'm assuming that's the default mode, and you get Adobe RGB and P3. Like, if you look at the little triangles on the color area, they're not quite the same, but they're similar.
Additionally, it has 80% of the Rec 2020 coverage, and they also leaned into, I don't remember where I read this, but they leaned into somewhere that it has DICOM medical imaging presets and the medical imaging calibrator to enable the use in diagnostic radiology. That's DICOM. The medical imaging calibrator on macOS is pending FDA clearance, but is expected to be available soon in the U.S. So that's something that's different, and I don't recall having ever seen before in Apple documentation.
Yeah, I mean, it's a high-end monitor. It has good color support. It is well-calibrated, and they're just trying to get a certification that allows it to be used in this particular way, because who else is going to buy this monitor at the prices that we're about to see?
12-megapixel center stage camera with desk view, which your Pro Display XDR does not have. A 6-speaker system with force-canceling woofers, and wow, I don't think I realized that. Force-canceling woofers, that's pretty cool.
That's not new. That's the Ultra Duo Display has that as well.
Does it?
Yeah.
The only difference in the speaker setups is 30% deeper bass.
Okay, fair enough. And so that's the same as the new non-XDR studio display. Now, I'm not snarking. Your display is only the display, right? No speakers, or does it have speakers?
No speakers.
Okay. Similar story with the two Thunderbolt 5 ports, up to 120 gigabits per second. One is for the host, which allows up to 140 watt charging, up from 96 on the non-XDR version. And then, again, you can the other one is for downstream with additional daisy chain.
Yeah, and they distinguish the ports by putting like a dot, like a little like bullet next to the one that is the charging port, essentially. And the other one is the daisy chain. Like, the upstream port has a dot on it. So, I mean, there's four ports in the back. So two have lightning bolts or thunderbolts or whatever. The two with little lightning bolt symbols are the thunderbolt ports. The one that has a lightning bolt and also a dot, that is the charging upstream one, and then the other one is the daisy chaining one.
All right, and then this, of course, also has an A19 Pro, as per Mac rumors. Also, there's a day one software update, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, and and by the way, it's they differentiated that as well, because remember, the other one has an A19, this one has an A19 Pro. I'm not entirely sure why it needs the A19 Pro, maybe to handle the dynamic backlighting stuff, because it's the same number of pixels, same, you know, everything, but maybe it's controlling the backlight displays, but that is a difference.
And then there was a big question from me about what is the story with regard to Mac support, because they had said, oh, it's a Thunderbolt 5 port. So I think we had talked about at some point in the past, well, is there enough bandwidth in any flavor of Thunderbolt to do 120 hertz at 5K? And I honestly don't remember what we concluded. I think we thought that there was, but only just...
There is, especially with display stream compression. But there are, like, as you're about to read, the compatibility specs for this are not entirely based on hardware features.
Right. So I had read, I was nervous at first because I'm kind of lusting after this thing. I was nervous that my lowly M3 Max wouldn't be supported because it's only Thunderbolt 4, not Thunderbolt 5. And I had assumed initially that, oh, you're going to need Thunderbolt 5 to support 120 hertz. As it turns out, that's incorrect. There is some information about what Macs are supported. Studio Display XDR is compatible with the following Mac models with Apple Silicon. Sorry, John. And macOS Tahoe 26.3.1 or later.
Sorry, anyone who doesn't want to update the Tahoe. This monitor requires Tahoe, presumably because of display drivers that are only part of Tahoe. But that's a software choice by Apple, and only supporting Apple Silicon is probably hardware-based, because I imagine the Intel ones might not be able to handle the adaptive sync stuff or whatever, or they just didn't write drivers for it. But anyway, these are not ridiculous requirements. The OS one is a little bit ridiculous. Like, you need the latest operating system to use a monitor? Really? That's kind of silly, but it's the truth. And Apple Silicon, like, whatever. Like, that's most Macs anyway, so it's fine.
So, basically, it's MacBook Pros with asterisks 2020 or later, MacBook Airs 2023, or I'm sorry, 2020 or later in some cases, the Mac Studio, Mac Mini, Mac Pro 2023 and later, see ya, John, or the 24-inch iMac. Then what's interesting is they say that they note that, well, let me just read it. Mac models with M1, M1 Pro, M1 Max, M1 Ultra, M2, and M3 support the Studio Display XDR at up to 60 hertz. all other Studio Display XDR features are supported. So that implies that to get 120 hertz, you need an M2 Pro Max or Ultra. You need an M3 Pro Max or Ultra. Woohoo! M4 Pro or Max, M5 Plain, M5 Pro or M5 Max.
Yeah, it's confusing, but like, do read the things, because you don't want to spend the money for this monitor and only be able to drive it at 60 hertz. Like, if you have like an M1 Ultra and you're like a really fancy computer that you bought, you know, Mac Studio M1 Ultra ages ago, you're like, I'm going to get this fancy new monitor and I'm going to get 120 hertz. You're not.
Right.
So, it's a bummer, but that is what it is.
With the environment, 100% recycled aluminum, standard glass display contains 80% recycled glass, 100% fiber-based box has been extensively redesigned for collapsibility, allowing it to be broken down into smaller pieces. It'll fit in most household recycling bins.
That's John, the YouTube video I want to see. I want to see someone getting a box. Like, because what does that mean? Like, do you, like, not have to use a box cutter to break it up? Does it, like, come apart with Velcro? YouTuber, please make this video. I want to see this box.
Quinn, get on it. All right, so you can pre-order them today as we record. They're available March 11th. We said the Pro Display XDR is not for sale. John, these are going to be incredibly affordable, right?
I mean, so here's the thing. The pricing, it replaces the Pro Display XDR, and thank God it doesn't cost what the Pro Display XDR did, but it costs a lot. So, but there, I think, all right, so here's the price. $3,300 with the standard glass, $3,600 with nanotexture. That's it. You get the adjustable stand as a no-cost option. Can you imagine that on a $3,000 monitor that it might come with a stand?
How generous
Amazing.
Of them.
Unthinkable.
It's a miracle.
However, I am very, very crabby about this. If you decide to opt for the Visa mount, which is what I would do because
you don't
I
save
on my own
money.
Stand, you save nothing. Good
right.
day, sir.
It's like when you get like an automatic or a stick shift and they're both no-cost options. It's like, well, they can't possibly cost the same amount.
Nope.
But that's yes. If you can get a stand or you can get no stand, and there is no savings for that.
I'm so mad.
Yeah. And so here's the thing with this price. First of all, I think it is somewhat unconscionable to have this price and not have like an iPhone quality, like good back camera as the camera. Because as far as I can tell, it has the same camera as the Studio Display, which granted is supposedly improved, but it's still 12 megapixel, whatever. But like a $3,000 monitor, I believe there should be room in the margins to put in a good camera from an iPhone, not a really cruddy one. But whatever, maybe it's hard to get those wide-angle ones. Like, they're really into center stage because they're not going to have a little motor moving the camera, so they want a wide-angle one. Like, I don't know what the issues involved are, but it just seems like a little bit of a shame that the camera isn't significantly better. I mean, hey, this has got the A19 Pro instead of the A19. Why couldn't they bump the camera as well? And the price, although it is somewhat offensive, this is the best big monitor you can buy from Apple, and it is a very good big monitor by the standards of the entire industry. It's not price competitive. You can get other monitors with the similar specs for less money, but it's not as if there are other monitors out there that are a million times better than this. Like, the specs of this, 1,000 nits sustained, 2,000 nits peak, 2,000 dimming zones, really good calibration, nice case. There's not a lot of monitors out there that are actually better than this monitor. There are only ones that are about the same for less money. And we call that a win. In the world of Apple monitors, we call that a win because you're paying the premium, but you're getting a premium monitor that looks really good and has modern specs, modern-ish specs. Like, again, 120 hertz, there are ones with higher rates than that, but this is not a gaming monitor. Like, over 120 hertz is kind of wasted on you scrolling your windows for the most of the times. You're not playing a video game where you want 144 or whatever, or like, you know, 340 or whatever. So like, for its purposes, as a color accurate, high quality, well-made Mac native monitor, the features of this are good and I give a thumbs up. The price is not so good, but what do you expect? It's the highest of the high end. And I say again, it is still less egregious than the XDR was, and certainly less egregious than the XDR was 2 days ago when it was still for sale with the same specs from like 6 years ago. So the XDR needed to be discontinued, like, to be clear. Like, it needed to either be price reduced, which is not a thing that Apple's super into, or discontinued. And so it was discontinued. I don't hold a grudge on that. I do continue to hope that someday Apple will release, like, bring it back at the same price, like a higher end monitor that is essentially like this but XDR sized, and just do it at XDR. Like, look at the price. This is $3,600. $5,000, $6,000 for an XDR with these specs, that's in line with these prices. Like, it's not out of step with this technology. So I really hope they do that someday. But Apple statements is them trying to say, we're not going to do that just by this monitor.
So should I buy this monitor? I don't think I have any justifiable reason for it, but I kind of want it really badly.
I think you would enjoy it because you are a 5K monitor enjoyer, and this is a better 5K monitor than all your other monitors, but it's probably too much money for somebody who's already got three perfectly serviceable 5K monitors. So, you know, I'm not saying wait and the price will go down because it won't. But
nope.
In 2 years, the specs on this will still be pretty good because this is, again, and not in the gaming realm, 120 hertz and these brightness figures are going to be competitive for several years in the realm of somebody who's looking at windows on their, you know, computer screen and pictures that they take. You know what I mean? Like, outside of the gaming realm, there's not this big race to crank these specs up. The brightness is going to continue to increase, and it's going to fall behind the competition probably, but it's going to be competitive for several years. So I don't think you need to have a, you know, run out and get this one. You can wait 2 or 3 years, and it will still be a good monitor in 2 or 3 years, and it'll be the same price.
Yeah, yeah, I think you'd have to be concerned. You know, you are a many monitors person, and mm-hmm. this would be like the promotion, especially, would be such that this monitor would make your other ones look bad. So this might not be.
Just put it in the middle.
Well, that's the thing is the current studio display is in the middle, and my LG Ultra Masses are on either side, and so I would do a similar trickle down as I would with the Apple TV, where this would go in the center, and the current studio display or the old now studio display would go to one side, and then I would be down to one LG Ultra Mass. But I'm not going to lie, for a fleeting moment, I thought to myself, should I get three of these? And the answer was immediately, absolutely not.
No. You're like, I just saved myself from buying a car. I mean, this...
That thought was my second thought, Marco.
Yeah, I'm just not sure this is
I mean, you know, we'll get to this probably in a little while, but like, I would maybe bank some of this for a new MacBook Pro in a few, maybe like 6 months, you know, like that kind of like when...
Yeah, the OLED ones, you know, you probably want one
like
of those.
When, if those rumors are correct, that those are coming, you know, sooner than normal for an upgrade cycle after the ones that just came out, that is probably something that you're going to want to spend a bunch of money on too. And so if you're like, you know, in this budget mindset of like, all right, I just saved myself from buying a car, why don't you take your family on a vacation, and then in, you know, 8 months when there's amazing MacBook Pros out, go get one of those.
Yeah. All right, so I feel like there was more to talk about here. I mean, how are you two feeling? I know you're grumbly about this, but like, what are you going to do if you ever have to update your monitor?
I'm mostly just feeling protective of my XDR and in fear of the red line disease that Underscore has, because if it dies, my options are now try to find a used one on eBay that doesn't have the same problems, or like downsize in monitors. And that's just not a thing computer nerds are used to, like getting over time. Again, computer nerds are used to their monitors getting bigger. Like I started out with a 9-inch screen. Now I have 32-inch. It's basically been a progression only upwards. I don't think I've ever regressed, because once you get used to more screen real estate, it's hard to go back. And because I am a one monitor person, not a multi-monitor person, it's just been my one monitor getting bigger and bigger. I would not want to go back to 27-inch. So I'm just sending good vibes to my XDR. Say, just hang in there. Keep going for probably only one more decade when Apple will release a new monitor that's bigger than 32 inches.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, when you are a user of something that gets discontinued, you know, see also the Mac Pro probably pretty soon.
God willing.
It's never a good feeling when the only company that makes the product that you use or can use or want to use stops making it, because that tells you like your needs don't matter, and also your needs can no longer be satisfied with new products. So like, that's never a good place to be. It's never a good place to feel, and it's never a good place to have your needs be, because what are you going to do? So in this case, like, you know, the XDR, it's not going to be easy to find a used XDR or a new one in any kind of reasonable condition within a year, because this was never a high volume product to begin with. So it's not like this was super popular and you'll be able, you know, if you wanted like a mint brand new in box, you know, MacBook Air from a few years ago, you'll find them because they make a ton of MacBook Airs and they sell a ton of MacBook Airs and people stock them. That's not the case for something like the Pro Display XDR. This is never a high-stocked, high-volume product, especially after, you know, 6 years of being out. And so if you want an XDR and you don't already have one, it's going to be hard to get one. You know, maybe you might be able to get one this week, maybe. But like, otherwise, it's going to become difficult. And so if your XDR breaks in 2 years, what the hell are you going to do? Like, what are you going to do? So the answer is, what? Like, I guess either get one of the third-party ones, which, as an Apple user, is always going to provide an inferior experience and an uglier case and an uglier, you know, situation, or downsize to this one. So spend, you know, $3,500 to have what you will perceive as a monitor that is better in some ways but worse in some pretty significant ones. And that's not a good feeling either. So I hope my XDRs stick around and last. And, you know, if I eventually have to replace them, I would probably, with a heavy heart, get this monitor. But I hope I don't need to anytime soon.
Yeah, and it would look good and everything. It's just less pixels. He just wants to get used to the room.
Screen space is really nice.
Yeah, if you had bought a Pro Display XDR last week, the one you got was probably manufactured 3.5 years ago.
Right.
Like, I think they stopped making these ages ago because the volumes were just so low, and I think they were just draining them out slowly but surely. And the used market is like, it's tough because I think a lot of the ones you would find would be like things that were used in like video editing studios or VFX houses or like other things like that that have essentially been used in a professional environment that get kind of beat up, you know, things that have been in and out of a Pelican case a lot, because those are the ones that are going to end up going on the market. Individual people are going to keep them until they die, and then they're going to, you know, get recycled or whatever. Who's selling working XDRs? It's like, oh, well, you know, some Hollywood studio had a whole bunch of these, and they just swapped in a bunch of new monitors, and so these are now, but those are always beat to hell because they're not treated gently. Like, it's not like, you know, old lady just drove it to church on Sundays. It's really worked hard. And so, yeah, finding, and especially if they have some kind of flaw in them, that like the red line happens after X number of years, if that's been sitting in a box in a warehouse for 3.5 years and you buy it quote unquote new, it could have the exact same, you know, problem with the red line or whatever other components are going to fail. I don't want to say anything too loud. Like mine is fine. It's been problem free, but like, please hang in there, XDR.
So if your XDRs, both of you, died today, Marcos, you said you would hold your nose and get a new XDR. John, what would you do?
I would thoroughly research the 6K options and see if there are any of them that I could tolerate the appearance of, probably. And if there wasn't, I would get the Studio Display XDR.
Yeah, I would wait a week, see what John found out about the other 6K options, and then figure something out.
Like, because I don't doubt that there are 6K monitors out there that are really good. It's just a question of me, like, do I think the case is ugly? And that may seem silly to you, but that's you know, that's what I like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like the way my office is arranged, every time that I take a phone call, I sit in a chair that is behind my monitor, and I get to see, as I'm on my phone call, I get to look at the back of my XDR and see all of its cool holes, and it's this beautiful, ridiculous, over-the-top design. I like seeing it. It's nice. And, like, you know, if I'm looking at, you know, the back of just some PC monitor, like, I don't know, it's just, I don't want to give it up. I've gotten accustomed to it, and it's nice.
Yeah, I get it. All right, M5 MacBook Air. The CPU is 10 core, which is 4 performance, 6 efficiency. All of the cores are working. The GPU is 8 or 10 core, 10 cores with all the cores working. RAM, 16, 24, 32 gigs. SSD starts at 512. There's no more 256 option. One terabyte, 2 terabyte, or 4 terabytes, which is new. It also has the N1. It supports up to 2 external displays, each of which can be either 6K at 60 hertz, like your ancient Pro Display XDR, or 4K at 144 hertz. Or you could go one display up to 8K at 60 hertz, 5K at 120 hertz, or 4K at 240 hertz. The environment story is same as the M4 we talked about earlier. What was that, the iPad?
The same as the MacBook Air M4.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. And then new with the environmental stuff is that it's manufactured with 50% renewable electricity. Pricing, $1,100 for 16 gigs RAM, half terabyte SSD, 8-core GPU, which is down $100 from the M4 with a half terabyte SSD, which is stunning, and up $100 from the M4 with 256 gig SSD.
Yeah, I mean, so this pricing is like, as we'll see when we get to the Neo, obviously, this was released the day before the Neo, but it's like, this is definitely leaving room for a lower-priced computer below it. So it is cheaper to get into a 512, but you could get into any MacBook Air for $100 less. You just got the crappy 256. So I think it's a reasonable move at the bottom of the pricing end. And we're not going to go into this much pricing detail with the other computers, because I feel like once you get up into higher amounts of pricing, it gets more difficult. But this is the low end. Well, other than the Neo, this is a lower priced item. And what counts the most is, like, what does it take for me to get into one of these? What is the base price? Is the base config good? And this base config is $1,100, 16 gigs RAM, 512 gig SSD. That's a pretty good base config, and it's $100 less than that same config with an M4. So you're getting a better SoC. All the other specs are the same, and it's $100 less. So I think that's a good deal, even if there is no more like $1,000 or $999 pricing option for this computer.
Right, and then RAM upgrades seem to be priced the same as before. To go from 16 to 24 is an additional $200. To go from 24 to 32 is an additional $200.
Yep, they held the RAM upgrades to their normal ridiculous prices, although now that RAM is ridiculously increasing, they're not as ridiculous as they were. As I said when we discussed this ages ago, like Apple, we don't know the details of Apple's deals, but very often they have made deals where they lock in a price for a certain volume of components for a certain period of time. And it is plausible that every computer that we're talking about today still benefits from a price they locked in before RAM prices went crazy. But that's not going to be true forever. They will have to eventually negotiate new deals for new periods of time for new RAM at new prices. And if the prices haven't dropped by then, I would expect some changes, not necessarily to those changes to be reflected in the RAM upgrade prices, but for Apple to shift around other things to make sure that they try to maintain margins. You'll hear that on their earning calls. We don't talk about their earning calls, but they always talk about what their margins are. But of course, they talk about their like overall margins. They don't break it down. And services are incredibly high margin. Hardware is less so. So when they say, oh, our margins were like 50% or whatever, it doesn't mean they have 50% margins on their hardware or all their hardware or any specific hardware. It just means overall across the entire things they sell, phones, services, you know, Apple Care warranties, like everything, our overall margins were 50%. I'm sure some products have margins that are higher than that. I'm sure some products have lower ones. And of course, services, I'm sure their margins are really high. So it's hard to back solve to see what they are. But I would imagine that if, you know, next year at this time, if RAM prices have not come back to sanity, we're going to be looking at products and trying to figure out where Apple buried the massively increased RAM costs. Right now, I'm not even sure Apple is experiencing massively increased RAM costs because of their long-term deals and because of when these might have been manufactured. So, you know, looking at the MacBook Air M5, it looks a lot like the MacBook Air M4 updated with the M5 and with some new specs. And it's nice that it gets the N1 because, again, Wi-Fi 7 and Bluetooth 6. It looks just like a straight-up good upgrade. The iPhone. MacBook Air M4 was a great computer. The MacBook Air M5 is also a great computer, and the price is reasonable.
All right. They've also announced the M5 Pro and M5 Max. The M5 Pro and M5 Max are built using a new Apple-designed Fusion architecture. The innovative design combines two dies into a single system on a chip, which includes a powerful CPU, scalable GPU, media engine, unified memory controller, neural engine, and Thunderbolt 5 capabilities. The M5 Pro and Max feature a new 18-core CPU architecture. It includes six of the highest-performing core design, now called Super Cores, that are the world's fastest CPU core. Alongside those cores are 12 all-new performance cores optimized for power-efficient multi-threaded workloads.
Can you please... So performance cores are now super cores, and efficiency cores are now performance cores, basically?
Mm-hmm.
What?
Well,
why?
Well, so keep going.
The industry-leading super core was first introduced as performance cores in M5.
We didn't even know it.
Mm-hmm. Which also adopts the super core name for all M5-based products. So they've retconned the plain Jane M5.
They just renamed the slow cores fast cores.
No, they didn't, though. So here, well, first of all, just this clarification from Andrew Cunningham from Ars Technica, who says that Apple's spec pages still draw a distinction between the efficiency cores in the M5 and the non-super performance cores in the M5 Pro, M5 Max. So basically, there's three kinds of cores from Apple's marketing perspective. There are super cores, which are essentially the most powerful cores in the M5 line. Those are called super cores. That's just a marketing thing. You could have just called them power cores there. Whatever the most powerful cores are inside a line of chips, Apple now calls them super cores in the M5 line, and it's true across the entire line. Then Apple says that they have a new kind of core, which is a performance core. So in some M5 chips, there's the super core, and then there's a new kind of core called the performance core, which is not the same as the efficiency cores in the plain Jane M5. So every chip has two kinds of cores, big ones and little ones. It's actually called big little in ARM parlance, right? The big ones are called super cores in the M5, but the little ones have two different names. Now, does that mean that the little cores in the M5 are different than the little cores in the M5 Pro and M5 Max? Probably, yeah. Probably they're actually different cores. So
having two different names
to them makes sense. The names themselves don't make any sense, but having these three names, power, super, efficiency, and performance, those three names refer to three actual different hardware things. And I think the reason they're different is, as we noted when we talked about the M5 chip, the M5 is not made using what Apple is calling their Fusion architecture. We were talking about it in TSMC terms as a SOICMH silicon on, I forget what it stands for, but it was like hyphen molding horizontal. Anyway, TSMC has a tech where you can take multiple dies and put it onto a thing and make a chip out of it. And we were talking about how that's better because you can make a bunch of littler dies and stick them together instead of trying to make one big one. The M5 doesn't do that. The M5 is all one die. It does not use this chiplet, you know, Apple Fusion architecture. So the M5 one is different, like physically different, manufactured in a different way than the M5 Pro and M5 Max. So there is a bifurcation in the line. Whole M5 line has these super cores, which fine is a renaming of the most powerful cores, but the M5 has the efficiency cores that presumably are similar to the efficiency cores in the M4 line. And the M5 Pro and M5 Max have essentially better efficiency cores, which are bigger and more powerful, and they're called performance cores. It's Apple. They really messed up the naming, but what they're going for is name different things differently. Now, there is an argument to be made that across the M1, M2, and M3, they kept calling them efficiency cores. Obviously, the efficiency cores change. The M1 efficiency core is not the same as the M4 efficiency core. We just kept calling them efficiency cores, but we always understood within the context of the M-whatever line, these are the efficiency cores. Now with the M5 generation, there's two different kinds of efficiency cores. And as Jason Snell pointed out, every time you talk to an Apple executive for years, and at WWDC they would say this, like I've heard people say this to me in person, literally, you know, those efficiency cores are actually pretty good. It's like, Apple, you name them efficiency cores if you don't like people calling them that. Because they were like, oh, I want to be on the power cores. Like in every WWDC session where that shows you how to use like core affinity and stuff like that, they're like, and don't be afraid to use the efficiency cores. They're actually really powerful. And people are like, well, no, of course, my code is important, so it needs to be on the power cores. Like, I get where Apple is coming from, but it's like, we didn't choose the names, Apple. You could have called them, again, the ARM nomenclature for the first chips it did is big little, where big is in all lowercase and little is in all caps, I think, which is also funny.
Yep.
But like, it's a marketing thing with a tech behind it, because they don't want people to feel like they're having lesser cores. And we'll see when we start looking at what's in these chips, the renaming also makes sense in the context of how they design them. But this is actually one of the most interesting years for the M chips in a long time. Not because the M5 line is, you know, super amazing and everything. It's good. Like, it's better than the M4. But, like, the Pro and Max are just plain manufactured differently. And having the CPU and GPU as, like, separate dies. Apple didn't release pictures of what this looks like. But as soon as someone gets these and slices it open, I'll love to see what's going on inside there. A, it opens up the possibility of something even cooler for the M5 Ultra. So we'll see if that ever materializes or even anything beyond that. But B, it is a split line. Plain M5 is essentially built differently than the Pro and the Max.
Yeah, and what's really interesting to me, and this is why I don't think we have benchmarks of these yet, do we?
We do. Well, no, not for the Pro and the Max.
Yeah, I really am curious to see those once those start coming out on Geekbench and stuff, because what they have done is a dramatic drop in the number of performance cores on the big chips.
No, that's not what they're called anymore.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, anyway, so the number of the big cores.
Yeah, go ahead, Casey. So read the specs. Well, it's actually, we can read Apple's base, like, overall performance claims before we get to the specs. So this is what they're saying, like, for the line of chips.
All right, so CPU up to 30% faster, quote, for pro workloads. And the M5 Max has 15% higher multi-threaded performance. The GPUs, up to 4 times the peak GPU compute for AI compared to the previous generation, and up to 35% faster, quote, for apps using ray tracing.
These are a lot of words.
The biggest number they've thrown up. Because otherwise, like 30%, 15%, like it's a generation, you know, the M5 is faster than the M4 in the usual amount, which is good, like 30%, 15%. Those are fine numbers for a generation. 4 times? That is a big thing, presumably due to improvements in the, I forget what they call it, like the the neural whatever crap that they put into their GPU cores in the previous generation.
That's something like what they called it.
Yeah. They put some processing stuff in each GPU core that is useful for doing like machine learning AI stuff. And I guess they improved that or I don't know if they improved it or have more of them, but anyway, Apple is making big claims about the GPU compute performance. And when they say previous generation, they mean the M5 Max versus M4 Max. So that's a big number, and that is significant because if you think about what kind of CPU or what kind of GPU bound workloads are people doing these days, AI is right up there, local on machine AI. So I mean, we'll have to see what the benchmarks bear out and how realistic that 4x number is, but it is the standout number in everything here.
Yeah, for the most part, like the regular base model M4 to the regular base model M5, it was a very similar thing of like, yeah, about 15% faster CPUs, and GPUs got better depending on what you were doing with them with these different accelerators. And so we're seeing roughly the same claims here about 15% faster multi-threaded CPU performance. Okay, let's see. I mean, again, like the core arrangement is radically different. The number of performance cores, the number of large cores has gone substantially down in these higher chips, and the number of smaller cores has gone substantially up. So it's kind of like a flatter design, so to speak, of like, the difference between the two cores probably has been greatly reduced. Only benchmarks and use will be able to tell us like if that makes a significant difference in either direction, but it is curious that like it's a radically different balance of power, so to speak.
All right, so the M5 Pro, the CPU is 15 core, which is 5 what, Marco? Super cores. And 10 performance cores versus the M4 Pro, which was 8 performance. So now there's 5 super. And
I hate all these binned counts. Yeah. It's driving me nuts. Like,
yeah, that's how they sell them. But here's what comes out is what Marco was saying. The old M4 was 8 and 4. 8 big, 4 little. The new arrangement is 5 and 10. So it's pretty much flipped. It used to be double the number of really good ones to the not as good ones. And now it's the opposite. It went from 8-4 to 5-10. So it's just total inversion. And that's why the naming makes sense, because look, when we talk about like power cores versus efficiency cores, like what do we actually mean on the M series chip? What is it about the P cores that makes them powerful? How are they different than the E cores and all the other lines of chips? Well, if you look at the die shot, you can say, well, first of all, I can see that the P cores are literally bigger. Like they're a bigger square on the chip. Why are they bigger? What is in that thing that makes them more powerful? And there's a bunch of answers to that. There could be and probably is more execution units. How many parts of the chip can add numbers together? You can have 2 adders, 3 adders, 4 adders. How many units are there for floating point multiplication? Like, you can literally put more execution units, more things that can munge numbers. You can add more of them because it's parallel dispatch. Like, it's not just one line through. So that's a way you can make them bigger. Another way you can make them bigger is you can add more cache, more L1 cache and stuff like that. That takes up die space. That's what makes the power cores bigger. You can have a more sophisticated branch predictor. You can have all sorts of stuff that makes it take up more room on the chip and more power and more transistors and more parts. That makes it a power core. And then the efficiency cores, they have less of that stuff. They take up less room. They take up less power. But the question always is, for a given workload, when you're sending something through like a power core, what if you don't have that many floating point multiplications? Those extra floating point multiplication units are just sitting there not being used because most of the workloads you're doing aren't doing lots of floating point stuff, so they're not doing anything useful. And at that point, if you had sent that same load through a quote-unquote efficiency core, it would have been just as fast or maybe even faster because maybe the pipeline is shallower or something like that, right? So you never quite know what the trade-offs are of like, should I send this to the bigger core and waste time winding through that machinery if it's not going to take advantage of most of the stuff that's there? And what it looks to me like is in the M5 Pro, and we'll see in the M5 Max as well, I think what they did is made the smaller cores bigger enough so that it makes more sense to have twice as many of them as the power cores. Before it was twice as many of the big cores as the little. Now it's twice as many of the little as the big. I think the way they did that, and we'll have to wait for a die shot to see if this theory bears out, is that they made the little cores big enough to essentially be the best choice for almost everything you do and only really, really specialize the bigger cores for jobs that are actually going to use all the machinery that they have, that need the more sophisticated branch prediction, that need the deeper pipeline, that need the extra execution units, that need the more L1 cache. And there's five of them. It's not like there's just one of them or something. There's five of them. There's plenty. But, I mean, and Apple knows this. I bet Apple looks at, like, workloads of, like, what do people actually do with Macs, and how can we make that more efficient? And so we'll see. Like, especially we'll see with, like, the performance, the power numbers, the battery usage and stuff. If they were able to flip this arrangement, going from twice as many big to little to twice as many little to big, and still get a performance increase, that, I think, says to me that they have made the correct trade-off, because they are presumably using less space. They're getting more cores, like, so, you know, 15 is more than 12, right? So they got three extra cores, similar power envelope, I would hope, and better performance. So I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt now and say this total inversion of big to little was a smart move, and it is suitable. It fits what people do with Macs, like, because that's their whole thing. They have the App Store. They know how people use. They have the OS. They make the hardware. They make the silicon. Like, their whole deal is, we can figure out how best to serve the workloads that people actually use our Macs for, and then make a chip that does that better than the previous one.
I think my major concern here, assuming that they have kept performance good at, you know, when you need it, which, you know, the benchmarks are, as the quoted metrics suggest that they probably have. We'll see what happens with the benchmarks. But there was a side effect that I'm not sure was intentional, but there was a side effect of having the low power cores be very low power. And that is that, you know, if you recall back in the days of everyone having these Intel Mac laptops, you would sometimes get one core at, you know, being used 100% by some background process, whether it was, you know, MD worker indexing, Dropbox, like, you know, whatever, you know, Chrome's weird updating things, like whatever it was, like, that you would often get a case where some kind of common app on the Mac or common background service would use 100% CPU, like, forever. And back on those old laptops, what that would do is make your laptop run hot, have crappy battery life, and have the fans kind of running all the time because it's some one thing in the background was using a bunch of CPU and keeping one of the cores really hot. When we moved to Apple Silicon and we had these like small low power cores as one of the options on the chip, macOS was very smart about how to dispatch things to them. And one of the things that macOS did was, as I think, everything running in the background would run only on the low power cores. And so a side effect of that, in addition to, you know, that just sounds good and, you know, keeping things under control, but a side effect of that is that when you would have one of those like runaway 100% CPUs, which background processes, it was only running on these low power cores, and they just didn't, they were so small and low power that even if you were maxing one out forever, it would have almost no noticeable effect on battery life, heat, or fan noise. If they make the smaller cores bigger, I hope they've somehow accounted to keep that still be the effect. Like, maybe background processes still get, you know, lower maximum thermal use. Maybe, you know, maybe the background processes still, you know, get their wattage limit or CPU usage over time. Maybe they run at a lower clock speed when they're in the background. Who knows? There's all sorts of advanced things they can do with power management now. But I hope that that effect of limiting the damage done to the user experience by runaway background processes, I hope that is maintained now that the smaller cores have gotten bigger.
I mean, I think they've gotten bigger maybe in terms of transistor count, but remember, this is a shrink as well, so they might not have gotten physically bigger. I
this is not a shrink. The next generation is a shrink.
Oh, versus the M3, I guess. This I forget if this one. Well, we don't know because this is the new. I don't know if the process is the same N3 whatever as the M5 because it is the chiplet thing.
Is it just the packaging different, or are they actually?
I don't actually know. I don't know if there is like an N3 letter that I don't know that it applies to the chiplet thing. But anyway, we'll see when they cut the die thing off of them. But
yeah,
here's the thing.
I think the process shrink isn't coming until the M6 generation.
Not like to 2 nanometer, obviously. These are all 3 nanometer. I'm just saying, is it N3P versus N3 whatever?
Right.
But we'll see, because they did go from 4 to 10 of these. So I bet they're still pretty small. And who knows if my theory about them being bulked up to be good for the majority of tasks is correct. It could be that they were already best for the majority of tasks, and they just learned that by, like, seeing real-world usage on the M4s. Again, we'll see when someone slices these chips open, and they'll map out, like, here are the different cores, and we can just physically measure them. Do they look about the same size as the old efficiency cores? Are they a little bit bigger? How much bigger? Also, there may be improvements in parts of the efficiency cores that can be turned off. As you said, there's clock throttling and everything, but, like, you know, as we see, the specs say the performance is better. The battery specs say that this performs about the same as the M4 one. So I'm optimistic that, I mean, it's not going to be a big impressive thing. This is just like a transitional phase of, like, we have a new tech for building chips. Can we do that tech transition at the same time as maintaining our normal year-over-year improvements while also doing this complete inversion of the ratio of our big cores to our little cores? And according to everything Apple has released, they're basically saying they've done it. We'll wait to see what the benchmarks are.
All right, the GPU is either...
Actually, you skipped the 18-core one, because this is the interesting thing. These come in 15 and 18-core, and the 18-core is just with everything enabled direct. It's 6 super and 12 performance, and so instead of being like the M4 was 10 big, 4 little, and this is 6 big, 12 little. Again, total inversion, but the 18 cores are the ones with everything working.
GPU 16 core or 20 core with enhanced shader core with second generation dynamic caching and hardware accelerated mesh shading. There is 307 gigabits per second memory bandwidth. This will become relevant soon. This is up 12.5% over the M4 Pro's 273 gigabits per second. For external displays, you can do 3, each of which can be 6K at 60 hertz or 4K at 144 hertz, or you can do 2 in a variety of different combinations I'm not going to read out. And it supports up to 3 external displays over a single Thunderbolt port.
You have 3 6K displays, if only Apple has still sold one of those.
if only. That would be like, what, $20,000 worth of displays?
Yeah, I guess you can buy third-party ones. But yeah, but the display support continues to be really good. And the 2 display support is weird because you have to pick like one of these monitors and then one of these other set of monitors, so like mixing. But the bandwidth is what it is. You're just slicing and dicing how much bandwidth you have with display stream compression to just. But the point is, this is what we're reading you now is the M5 Pro, remember? Really good display support, because the M5 Pro, as we noted before, when Apple said the M5 Pro and the M5 Max feature a new 18-core architecture, guess what? The M5 Pro and the M5 Max are basically the same except for GPU cores. So it's going back to the M1 and M2 generation when the Pro and the Pro was just the Max with some GPU cores lopped off. Now, this is not, I don't think it's a lopping off thing. We'll have to see what, you know, again, because the whole architecture is different with separate dies inside the package and stuff, but that's the upshot, that the Pro, this is a good Pro year. If you don't care about GPU, the Pro has all the same goods as the Max, essentially, modulo binning, and you just have fewer GPUs inside there.
Yeah, this is a great, like, I mean, geez, I've really been eating some crow on this, on my Pro opinions the last couple of weeks, but, like, this is a great year for the Pro buyers. And in fact, like, I think if I were buying today, and if the amount of RAM I wanted was available in the Pro, I would buy the Pro. No question.
How much RAM do you want?
Well,
we'll get to that when we get to the computers. We're still just doing the SoCs. But anyway, yeah. The Max, it only comes in 18-core. So that's just, you know, market segmentation. They could make it with, you know, the 15-core in it, but they don't. So you get the M5 Max, you get it with everything working. So again, it's 6 big cores, 12 little ones. There's no wondering which one you're going to get. All the Maxes have everything working. You do get a choice in the GPU. You can get the even bigger, because the Pro has a 16-core or 20-core GPU. The Max has 32 or 40. Those are your two choices. So the big GPU thing has twice as many cores as the Pro. Again, if you don't care about GPU, the CPU parts are the same if you get them, like, not the non-binned ones. So, yeah, good year. Memory bandwidth, interestingly, varies based on the number of GPU cores. I don't know if it's related to the GPU cores. It might be, but because they need to be fed, but it might just be a segmentation. But anyway, the M5 Max, all the CPU cores always work, but when you pick how many working GPU cores you want, if you get the 32 GPU core one, you get 460 gigabytes per second, which is 12.2% increase over the similarly bin 32-core M4 Max's GPU. And if you get the 40-core GPU, you get 614 gigabytes, which is, again, 12.5% over the 40-core M4 Max's GPU. So be aware of those differences there. And the display support is just ridiculously good. This is the only one that says just native DisplayPort 2.1 speeds. I don't think they said DisplayPort stuff for the other ones. But anyway, four displays. You can do four 6K displays if Apple sold them. Or, you know, two displays of varying variety. It's a huge amount of display bandwidth. You won't have any problem with this. Supports up to four external displays over a single Thunderbolt port. It's pretty amazing. It's a pretty beefy GPU for what, will, as we will see, is a laptop GPU. Good chip.
Yeah, this is really impressive. I'm not in the market for a new MacBook Pro, and let me tell you, I priced one, and it was over $6,000 the way I would probably build it, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I'm very curious about, and we don't necessarily need to cover this now, but I wonder if I would want to pick a Max, which is what I've had. I had an M1 Max and M3 Max right now. Would I want to pick the Max for the increased memory bandwidth? And I don't, maybe not.
No, not for what you do with it. Absolutely not.
Fair. All right. Well, that answers that.
Well, that's why it's a good year for people who do not care about GPU. This is the year to get the Pro because it's back at the old days where you're giving up if you don't get the binned one is you're giving up GPU that you weren't going to use anyway. And hey, that's less heat and everything, so it's a win.
I mean, the real question when with picking these, I guess we'll get to this maybe a little bit later, but like, the real question with picking these is like, how much will this matter for AI stuff in the near future? Like during the lifetime of this laptop, how much will it matter for AI stuff? Because that's obviously like a major, you know, thing going on right now. Sorry, everybody. Yes, I'm talking about it. And so, you know, there's a question of like, well, what if I wanted to run local models? And I think like what we have seen so far is that while we can run local models on some of the higher end Macs, if we shove enough RAM into them for $1 million, that's not really a mainstream thing. That's not really a thing that most of us need to do or will do or will be able to do in a way that is competitive with what the big server side models are able to do for us. Will that change over the course of owning your next laptop if you're looking to buy one of these? I don't think anybody can really say. But like, how much are you willing to throw down, you know, thousands of dollars for really high specs that you might end up barely using because what you're mostly using, your big grunt CPU power, is like happening in data centers somewhere.
Yeah, I would bet against it. I mean, there is a possibility because these companies are highly motivated to reduce the cost of inference. So basically, can we get a way to run models with less power, like less CPU power? That would, they're highly motivated to do that because it saves them a lot of money, right? If there is a breakthrough in that area, if they say, oh, we've found a way to run models that work like our current ones, but use half the RAM or something, like that is the only way that you will get the benefits of like future benefits of running local models. Because right now, unless you already know that you want to run, if you're not already running local models, don't buy a machine for the purposes of running local models. Because if you buy this machine today, right now, models are just getting bigger and bigger and harder to run locally if you're talking about the bleeding-edge models. If you care about the bleeding-edge models, don't run them on your laptop, right? You have to run them in a server because a lot of them you just literally can't run because you're not going to have enough memory, right? So unless there's a breakthrough in that, or unless you're very interested in running small local models, again, you're probably already doing that. So if you're not currently running local models, do not buy an M5 Mac Pro based on your ability to run local models. Because if you're not already doing it in the future, you're just going to be less likely to do it because the models are just going to get bigger and more demanding. And honestly, if you know, most people probably should be using the bigger models because they're just more capable and you don't want to run them yourself. Like they're so demanding. Like there's a reason those GPUs that they're running them on cost like $60,000 or whatever, and there's multiple ones. You don't want to be doing that yourself, unless you're already doing it. Because if you're already doing it, then you know, and what you should probably do is get like an M5 Pro Mac Mini or something someday, because that's what you want. It's like maximum bang for small amount of buck or whatever. So, yeah, I wouldn't. Like, I just feel like we're at such early stages. It's like, okay, maybe you can run like some local model today, but in 3 years, that local model is going to be garbage. Like, what do you care?
Yeah.
All right, the M5 Pro and the M5 Max both support memory integrity enforcement, which we've talked about on and off over the last few months.
Yeah, that was introduced with the A19 series and the M5, and just clarifying, the whole M5 family supports it. And the everything before that in the M family does not.
All right, the M5 Pro and M5 Max MacBook Pros, 14, 16 inches, just as before. The M5 Pro, you can get the 15-core CPU, 16-core GPU with 24 or 48 gigs of RAM. You can get the 18-core CPU, 20-core GPU at 24, 48, or 64 gigs RAM, which is new. That was what forced my hand on the Max in the past, is that I always wanted 64 gigs RAM, and now I wouldn't have to both of your points earlier. John Gruber pointed out that this means the price for a MacBook Pro with 64 gigs of RAM, if that's your main concern, hello, dropped by $800 year over year. Last year, you needed to buy one of the high-end M4 Max chips to get the 64 gigs. That's very good news. However, it comes with an SSD of 1, 2, or 4 terabytes, no half-terabyte option, which means for me and my fancy lad 8 terabytes, I'm back in the M5 Max.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. Like, Apple does have to sort of segment these, like, again, doing 24 and 48, like, all right, well, 24, 48, and 64, like, the segmentation makes some sense, but, like, the SSD is really not particularly related to the SoC in a way that explains the lack of an 8 terabyte. It's just market segmentation.
And then the M5 Max, you can do with the 32-core, you get 36 gigs of RAM, and you will like it. For the 40-core, you can do 48, 64, or 128 gigs of RAM. SSD in 2, 4, or 8 terabytes. And then between the two of them, all of them share the same screen, which is unchanged for the M4 Pro and Max. 1,000 nits, up to 1,600 peak on HDR, 120 hertz, nanotextures, $150. Has the N1 with Wi-Fi 7 and Bluetooth 6. Size and weight is unchanged. Ports unchanged. Battery is largely unchanged, although slightly different amounts of video streaming and wireless web, which is their, ridiculous.
Yeah, and mostly, like, so the M5 Pro gives you 2 more hours of video streaming. So that's, I mean, that's a measurable increase over the M4 Pro, right? So that's reasonable. M5 Max is down an hour with wireless web and down an hour with video streaming. So that's interesting. And the battery sizes are unchanged on these models. The 14-inch is still 72.4 watt hour for both of them, I believe. So it seems like basically a wash. But again, the numbers that Apple always gives you with battery is like, we don't know how you perform these tests. What the heck is wireless web? Like, what are you doing? So as usual, battery testing, well, I'm sure will be all over the place. But it will be instructive to see how these new we keep saying chiplet architecture. It's probably the wrong term, but it's a nice way to visualize more than one die inside the package. How will they behave in terms of thermals, battery life? To Marco's point, how does the change in ratios of big to little cores affect things? You're not going to tell from looking at these battery numbers. We'll have to wait for people to test them.
All right. And then the microphone, quote, voice isolation and wide spectrum microphone modes for enhanced voice clarity in audio and video calls. The environment.
Oh, you skipped over the 16-inch battery. It's interesting that the 16-inch battery is exactly the same for the M5 Pro, but the 16-inch battery is plus 2 hours on wireless web and plus 1 hour on video streaming for the Max. I don't understand. Like, they didn't change the battery size at all. So why does the Max and the 14-inch go down an hour and the Max and the 16-inch goes up an hour? Like, it's very weird. I don't quite understand. If they had changed the battery sizes, this would make sense to me. But, it's the same chip in a 14-inch and a 16-inch laptop, and it seems to get different performance.
All right. The environment story is largely the same as the M4 Pro and Max. However, new is that it's made with 45% recycled content and manufactured, again, with 50% renewable electricity. The price for the M5 Pro and M5 Max starts at $1,700 for the 14-inch and $2,700 for the 16-inch.
I had to check that like 3 times. I'm like, this has to be wrong. I must have the wrong windows open. How can the starting price for the M5 Pro and M5 Max be exactly the same? And the answer is, I think that they're just like, it's not apples to apples because they're, different number of cores are disabled, different amount of RAM, like the base configs are different. But I believe, triple check me, they both start at $1,700, whichever chip you pick, Pro or Max.
That does seem a little bananas to me.
On the 16-inch, maybe.
On the 14-inch.
Are you sure? Because I'm seeing it.
Triple check me. I might be wrong.
I'm seeing it say M5 Pro is from $2,349. M5 Max is from $3,749. Yeah, it's $3,749. Like, the M5 Max dramatically ramps up everything. Let me see.
All right, maybe I did it wrong. That's why I doubted myself. I'm going to do it. I'm going to check it.
Yeah, I think
it,
because it's like $1,300 more for the Max.
All right, shop.
But they really have, yeah, as Casey was saying earlier, like they really have restricted a lot of the high memory and SSD configurations to the Max chip. Even like if you want the 8 terabyte SSD, you can't just get a Max. You have to get like the highest. Like it's just everything is like you have to really max out the processor to get the most RAM or SSD.
Yeah, maybe I was just clicking on the wrong things. All right, set that aside. That's not true.
All right, well, do we want to reboot this whole thing then?
No, you can leave in my mistake. Like, I swear, I checked it like 3 times. You know what it is? They've changed the product configurator. There was a story about this a while.
Yeah.
Like how you don't pick like good, better, best. You just basically go into the configurator. But the way they've made like the clicking of like, you know, you have to like pick a color first or we won't let you pick anything else. Now pick a screen and we won't let you pick anything else. When you get down to the chip section, they have these sort of collapsing set of round recs. And I think they've bamboozled me because when you click on the chip, like there's another rectangle that appears where you have to pick like the number of cores and stuff. And I just think I got confused. My bad. Anyway, that's why I double check correct in real time. The Max is super duper expensive. Sorry about that.
All right. So yeah. So basically, the Max is, as you said, super duper expensive. But the RAM upgrades seem to be priced same as before. Same basic story as before. We don't need to enumerate them, but you know, all the pricing doesn't really change.
Like when you go to a higher RAM level, you're paying the same ridiculous prices you were always paying. They just seem less ridiculous now because RAM prices are really high everywhere, but the point is Apple didn't actually increase their RAM upgrade prices.
Yeah, which
they
good
were
for them.
So ridiculous they were able to absorb the changes, or they locked in their prices before and they're getting exactly the same margins they always did.
And I think what's interesting about this too is like, you know, Apple historically does not change these prices during the lifetime of that product. So what they, you know, by keeping the prices the same, what they are communicating is not only probably is this, you know, a comparable buy now than it was before, you know, and relative to the rest of the market, it's becoming a better buy. But also, Apple seems most likely to expect that they will not have to change this price at all, at least until the next MacBook Pro comes out. That's impressive, you know, given the current environment. You know, we always hear that Apple establishes long-term relationships with suppliers and they guarantee themselves a certain amount of stock and certain good price terms and everything. We've also been hearing recently, and I think this is probably true, that Apple is no longer like the darling customer of some of the big chip fabs and memory suppliers and things because all of these component orders coming in from all the AI companies, you know, they're like all of a sudden like the new good customer for TSMC and like, you know, like NVIDIA is buying a whole bunch of chips from TSMC and, you know, everybody making their own AI accelerators, like they're all buying a bunch of chips from TSMC. Everyone's buying a bunch of memory from the memory companies besides Apple now. So like Apple is no longer necessarily like the only or the biggest significant customer to the fabs and the component suppliers. So you would think, based on all of that, you would think that Apple would not be able to get as good of terms from everybody for their supplies and their pricing and their availability and everything as they are accustomed to getting. So either they still are getting great terms or they just think like it will be able to weather whatever temporary blip there is, and then, you know, in a few years when things are more calm, maybe, you know we will have absorbed it. But that's none of that is what we expected. We all expected memory prices would go up with the new generation.
I didn't expect that. I would have bet with Gruber on this.
Oh, good job.
Because, like, again, because the long-term contracts, the fact that these products are still well within a reasonable window of a long-term contract, and if any company on Earth has room in its RAM margins to absorb a RAM increase, it's Apple. Because their prices have been, like, we did the math on it a while ago. It was, like, 6.5 times market prices or something. Like, they had room. They had room in there. And, you know, I just think these products, this generation, even though they're being released now, these have been in the pipeline for a while. I just think we don't see a reflection of the changes that you just described, Marco, in these products. And if they do need to, like, again, with like the OLED models, if they do need to absorb that cost somewhere, I feel like they'll shave the cost somewhere else and leave their RAM prices somewhere. But we'll see. And this is another quite slightly baffling one. the storage prices have gone down a little bit, which is only baffling because we're in the weird world of Apple. Like, everywhere else in the industry, of course storage prices go down year over year because you can get bigger SSDs for less money over time because that's how technology progresses, right? Yeah. Not in Apple land. They just keep the same prices forever and ever. The only reason the prices change is, like, eventually one of the sizes falls off the end because it becomes too embarrassing even for Apple to ship. And that did happen. Like, they dropped some of the lower configs. But here on the MacBook Pro, M5 Pro and M5 Mac, MacBook Pros, a config with a 1 terabyte SSD is now $100 cheaper than it used to be, and going from 1 to 2 is $200 cheaper than it used to be, and going from 2 to 4 is $200 cheaper than it used to be. And this is also true for the M5 MacBook Pro, not just the M5 Pro one. I think they adjusted those storage prices as well. So storage prices went down slightly. Again, their storage prices are also ridiculous, and, like, you know, going from 1 terabyte to 2 terabytes is not a $200 increase in most scenarios. But, you know, we accept those prices because it's the only, we have no other choice, and it's nice to see them go down. So, as Casey found, if you spend a while in that configurator clicking on these round wrecks and watching things collapse and whatever, and build the computer of your dreams, it will cost the price of your nightmares, I guess. It's not going to work out well for you, especially since Apple does, I mean, they have to have some reasonable number of configs. They drive you towards stuff. Like, again, if you get the M5 Max, no, there's no binned option for you. You get the one with everything enabled, and you pay for it, and you have no choice. And if you want a larger amount of RAM, tough luck. You can't get the lower power CPU if you want that extra bit of RAM. You got to, you know, so that's just the way it is. And honestly, I think the configurability of, in particular, the M5 Pro and M5 Max MacBook Pros is pretty okay. There are a lot of options, but no, there's not infinite options. You can't, you know, as we surmise, like, oh, with this chiplet architecture, they can mix and match the CPUs and GPUs. Yeah, Apple can mix and match them, but it's not like there's going to be a configurator where you pick how many cores and they manufacture it on demand for you or something. They just picked a bunch of configs that they think fit the lineup and they spread them out. And I think it is reasonable. Maybe the most egregious thing is, like, limiting of the RAM on the chips with less GPU, but they kind of always do that. But in the grand scheme of things, it is a better year than normal because the Pro chip has the same CPU as the Max chip, as long as you don't need that extra RAM.
Yeah, so if you need or desire an 8 terabyte drive, you are looking at $6,250.
Fun.
Yeah, with 64 gigs of RAM, for what it's worth. But yikes.
To be clear, like, this is, like, top of the line performance. Top of the line everything. Like, you know, this is a laptop, but, you know, this is exactly the kind of thing I use a laptop as a desktop for. Like, I have a high spec MacBook Pro, you know, mine's the M3 generation, so 2 years older than this, but, or two generations older than this, rather. But if you are trying to have, like, a Mac Pro, so to speak, this is a really good way to do it for most people. And so that's what we're talking, like, when you look at, like, what did it cost to spec out, like, an iMac Pro or, you know, other Mac Pros before they were whatever the heck the monster of there is now. You know, it was always in, like, you know, if you wanted the highest RAM config, the highest processor config, the highest storage config, you were always, like, you know, $5,000 to $7,000. Like, that's always roughly where that got you. So for what this is getting us, I don't think this pricing is unprecedented and necessarily even unreasonable. It's just, this is a very high-end product, and we're talking about very high-end resource levels for what it is.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of cheddar. All right, and then finally, we have what we all were expecting, the low-cost MacBook, with a name that we weren't expecting until yesterday when it was leaked. But that's okay. It was leaked yesterday. Like I said, there's a article at Mac Rumors, which we'll link. Also, Buck points out that Cupertino and Apple have kind of sort of stolen a name of a Surface. The Surface Neo is an unreleased dual touchscreen 2-in-1 PC that was unveiled by Microsoft on October 2nd of 2019. Whoopsie doopsie.
I mean, I think they're allowed to steal a name that's 7 years old from something that never came out.
Usually you see, like, Apple, you know, for better or for worse, mostly for worse, setting naming trends like Pro and Max, which suddenly appeared on every other thing in the universe app, or Apple started using them, not because they're good names, but just because Apple essentially made them have good values associated with them by naming their products. So then, Yeah. But in this case, they're bringing Neo is, you know, has been in product names for ages, even before the Matrix. And it is again, but if this trend catches on and people start calling their products Neo, I think people will attribute it to Apple, but other people have been out there first. It's just a question of, like, when Apple does it, it seems cool and people copy it.
All right, so what do we got? A18 Pro, the CPU is 6 cores, 2 performance, but not super, right? Because it's only the M5.
And everything except for the M5 Pro and Max, the old names still apply.
All right, so 2 performance, 4 efficiency, that is not binned. The GPU is 5 core, which 6 core would be unbinned. There is no fan, John. The benchmarks with the iPhone 16 Pro Max as a stand-in, pretty good. I mean, John, how would you like to... There's a lot of numbers in our show notes.
So, like,
here,
the iPhone 16 Pro is the Max is the stand-in because it's got the same thing. It's got an A18 Pro, and I picked the Pro Max instead of the Pro, figuring, like, it's the biggest, so it's the closest analog to a laptop because, I don't know, there's more room inside it or whatever. So we'll have to see what the actual benchmarks are, because for all we know, it is clocked higher, it has better cooling, and that we don't know. But the using just the Pro Max as a stand-in, which I think is a reasonable kind of, like, conservative estimate of how this chip is going to perform in a laptop scenario, assuming they didn't really screw up the cooling. Here's what it looks like. Single core CPU is 19% slower than an M5, 30% faster than an M1, and 90% faster than the M2 Mac Ultra Pro and the Mac Pro.
Oh, so not even your Mac Pro.
No, this is the current Mac Pro. Oh. It is 19% faster in single core than the current $7,000 Mac Pro that you can buy right now at Apple.com. This, the MacBook Pro Neo, has 19% faster single core performance.
That's amazing.
It is 2.5 times faster than the single core performance of my Mac Pro, because I know you want to know that. Just FYI. Multi-core. It is 1% faster than the M1, or 1% slower. Again, the caveat with, like, Geekbench stores, if you look them up, Geekbench has, like, a leaderboard, and I, like, pulled from that. But if you look at individual results, they vary all over the place, because, I don't know, people are putting their things in ice packs, or, like, who knows? Like, the numbers always vary by a few percent. So don't, like, when I say 1% faster, just assume it's, like, it's a wash. But these are the numbers that I pulled out of the top charts, right? So I have the exact numbers here in the document. But, you know, who knows how exact they are, because, again, it varies. It's 2 times slower in multicore than the M5. It's 2.5 times slower than the M2 Ultra and the Mac Pro. So the $7,000 Mac Pro is 2.5 times as fast in multicore than Apple's cheapest phone chip powered laptop.
Costs about as much as one wheel on the Mac Pro.
Yeah. And my Mac Pro is 20% faster in multicore. So go my Mac Pro. It's ridiculous. GPU-wise, it is 2.2% slower than the M1, so I would call that a wash. It is 2.3 times slower than the M5, 7 times slower than the M2 Ultra and the current Mac Pro, and 4 times slower than my Radeon Pro Vega 2. So Jason Snell has some charts that we'll link. You can see his numbers are slightly different than mine, because, again, when you look up Geekbench stuff, there's lots of individual... You run the Geekbench app, and you upload your results to the website, and tons of people doing that. You get wildly varying numbers depending on what was going on in their system, what temperature things were, all sorts of variables that are not under your control. But Geekbench does publish, like, I don't know how they do it, they average it or something. They publish, like, top charts, where, you know, organized by machine and CPU. And that's where I was pulling mine from. And I don't know if Jason's numbers are slightly different, but here's what it boils down to. This thing, for single core, is actually better than the M1. And for multi-core and GPU, it's about the same as the M1. So if you want to characterize what is it going to be like to use a Mac with the A18 Pro, the specs say from Geekbench, which again is just a benchmark, but whatever, the specs say that it should be roughly like using an M1 that is a little bit peppier in single core. And single core does make a difference for people just doing, you know, dorking around on their computer and doing stuff, because the main thread in your application, the thing you're interacting with, that's probably that one single thread is probably going to be in a power core because it's an interactive thread and all this other stuff. And that core, single core performance is faster in the 18 Pro than it is in the M1 by a significant amount. 19% is not, like, within the range of variability of Geekbench scores. So that's good. Now, there are some unknowns as we get to more of the specs of here, like, okay, but there's more to an SoC's performance than just CPU, GPU, single core, multi-core. Like, there's more to it than that. There's more of the whole system performance. So we'll have to wait until somebody gets one of these and starts actually benchmarking it to know, because the phone is not a good stand-in in other ways, but just pure CPU benchmarks, that's how I would characterize the 18 Pro, is it's M1-ish. RAM is 8 gigs. There's no choice, no other option. It's just 8 gigs is 8 gigs. You got to save money somewhere, but like I imagine that the main reason it's 8 gigs is I don't think the 18 Pro can handle more than 8 gigs. I don't think it's ever shipped with more than 8 gigs. I guess they didn't modify it. Like, so I'm guessing, I mean, not saying they wouldn't have gone 8 gig anyway, but they did just bump everybody up to 16, including the M1 MacBook Air. They bumped up that configuration as well, not the Walmart one. But this has 8 gigs, and I don't think they're trying to do it to be stingy. I just think, like, you can't do more than that with the 18 Pro. The A19 Pro, I think, can do 12.
Yes.
So I suspect if you do see a bump in this, like next year or the year after or whatever, the next time they make a new MacBook Neo with an A19 Pro in it, I bet it will have 12 and not 16, but we'll see. But like, if you're disappointed about the RAM, I think it is a side effect of Apple deciding to make a low-cost MacBook and essentially being forced to use one of the chips that already exists, and that chip was never really designed to be a Mac chip, so either doesn't support more than 8 gigs, or it's difficult to get it to support more than 8 gigs, and that topic will come up in a little bit when we talk about more things. Memory bandwidth, 60 gigs per second, which is 1/10 as fast as the top spec M5 Max, to characterize that, but it is 12.5% slower than the M1. So it is, again, ballpark, how much memory bandwidth does this have? It has M1-ish memory bandwidth, a little bit less. SSDs is a real wild card for me in benchmarks. Yeah, so it comes to a 256 or 512 with some important differences we'll get to in a second. I don't know what the SSD speeds are going to be like, because honestly, I don't know what the SSD speeds are like in phones, and I imagine the A18 Pro's interface to storage is the bottleneck here. Like, however fast an A18 Pro can talk to storage, that's how fast this is going to go. Even though Macs, like any of the M chips, are probably designed with faster storage, especially like the modern ones are designed with faster and faster access to storage, whether it's higher clock speed or wider buses or both, we'll have to see what the SSD performance is like on the A18 Pro, because I don't know how to like handicap that. So like, if your workload depends a lot on, you know, big sequential reads of high bandwidth stuff, maybe it won't perform like an M1 for you. But if it doesn't need to do that and it's just like CPU bound, it should perform kind of like an M1 to you.
I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that if you know what RAM is, if you know what memory bandwidth is, and if you know what SSD performance is, this is probably not a computer that's really targeted at you. And that's fine. Like, and also, when you look at, like, you know, this is an iPhone chip performing very competitively, in certain ways, very competitively, and in certain ways, of course, it's restricted and lower. But that really says a lot about the iPhone. It's like the iPhone can do a lot here. Like, if the power that we're carrying in our pockets every day is enough to run like a somewhat competitive like entire laptop, that's amazing. It's also kind of amazing to think, like, if you, like, you know, build and run from Xcode on this computer to an iPhone 17 Pro,
yeah,
the phone that you're running it on is going to be faster than the computer you're building.
Keep in mind that if you buy one of the new displays, either one, it has a more powerful SoC.
Oh, gosh.
Well, because the Studio Display has an A19, and the Studio Display XDR has an A19 Pro, and this is an A18 Pro. So, yes, if you buy this and attach it to one of those external monitors, which it will drive, your monitor has a better SoC. I wonder if it has more RAM.
Yeah, but you
RAM
can buy, too, like, seven of these for the cost of one of those monitors.
Yes, that is definitely true. All right, so size-wise, if you were hoping for the return of the MacBook One, and yes, many people pointed out that MacBook Neo is an anagram of MacBook One.
Yeah, this is
a,
it.
It doesn't have one port, which we'll get to in a little bit, but B, this is not a ridiculously skinny laptop. It is essentially MacBook Air-sized. It is actually 1.5 millimeters thicker than the MacBook Air, and it is 6 millimeters less wide and 8 millimeters less deep. But it is actually thicker. So it is not a skinny little thing. It is not a wedge. It is not smaller than the MacBook. Just, again, think of this as essentially MacBook Air-sized, a little bit smaller. The weight is exactly the same as the MacBook Air, so if you wanted a 2-pound thing, this ain't it. It's and that's 2.7
okay.
pounds.
I have some questions about the weight. Because, okay, this is roughly the same size computer as the MacBook Air.
It's a little bit smaller.
Yeah, a little bit, but barely smaller. It is thicker. Yeah, but so it's a roughly a MacBook Air 13-inch sized computer. It is exactly the same weight as the MacBook Air. It has many of the same types of things in it as a MacBook Air, except it has a much smaller battery.
It
and
does
batteries are heavy. Why is it the same weight?
Here's my guess. One of the rumors that they talked about this, Apple alluded to it vaguely in their video, is that they have come up with a less expensive way to make an aluminum unibody chassis. And it's possible that less expensive way does not remove all the material that could be a move, be removed for the most efficient weight.
Oh,
that's my guess.
So like thicker aluminum, basically.
Yeah, like because like when you're the more expensive one, like, you know, there's a bunch of aluminum there that's not serving a role structurally, and removing every ounce of that may require more machining and precision and so on and so forth. And whatever the new technique is, that I don't remember the details of the rumors, so this is just rumors of like they've found a way to make a unibody aluminum construction for less money than like the M1 MacBook Air. That's my only guess. Because you're right, the battery.
That's a pretty good
guess. The display, no notch, which I like. Like, I feel like that's an advantage over the MacBook
right.
Air. I mean, it's because they have big bezels around the screen. Like, that's what it comes down to. But, you know, no notch. If you didn't like the notch, just don't have one. It's a 13-inch IPS LCD, as opposed to, I think, the MacBook Air is 13.6 inches. The resolution, it's 219 pixels per inch. The resolution is actually less than the MacBook Air. It's 2408 by 1506 versus 2560 by 1664. It is also, by the way, significantly less than the iPhone 16 Pro Max that this SoC came from. The iPhone 16 Pro Max, remember, the iPhone 16 Pro Max is 3X instead
right.
of 2X. The iPhone 16 Pro Max is 2868 by 1320 at 460 PPI. So if you're worried, like, how is this phone chip going to drive this display? It has so many pixels. Don't worry about it. The phone that it came from has more pixels.
That's awesome.
It's 500 nits. It's only sRGB, so no P3, no True Tone, no ambient light sensor. The ports. This is where the A18 Pro comes in again. It has one USB 3 that does 10 gigabits per second for charging and display port, but it can do one display at 4. I guess it can't do the 6K. It's one external display at 4K at 60, so it couldn't do the 6K display. But it can do the 4K display. It can't do the 5K display either, which is a bummer. Anyway. And then the other port, thank God it has more than one, so it is not a MacBook One. The other port, which is also USB-C, is USB 2 at 480 megabits per second. And why? Why the hell does it have a USB 3 port and a USB 2 port? Because that, I think, is what the A18 Pro
yeah.
can support. I think Gruber mentioned this in one of his things.
He said in his piece that he actually asked somebody in Apple PR, and they basically said like it was really hard to even get that port in there.
They could, like, in other words, saying, like, normally they expect to have one port. It's a phone chip, so you have one port in the phone, right? Just to get the second USB port at all, I think they probably had to add, like, another USB controller somewhere to the board and wire it in, and that was a pain. And so, yes, Apple did this to themselves, but, when the A18 Pro was made, I don't think there was any expectation that this chip would appear in a Mac. It is ill-suited to be in a Mac based on the peripheral stuff, and so it is disappointing. I mean, come on, USB 2? Like, what century is this? It's ridiculous. But would you rather only have one port? I sure as hell wouldn't. So there is the good port, the quote-unquote good port, which is, again, only USB 3 at 10 gigabits. And then there is the horrendously slow port. But it's still better to have two ports because there is no MagSafe. These two ports are it. Well, you know, charge in one of them, connect a peripheral in another. When the A19 or A20 or whatever powered version of the MacBook Neo comes out, I'll bet these changes are less bad. Or I'm hoping in the future Apple says, okay, if this product is a hit, we need to make chips that we know will work in this. This is a disappointing technical thing, but it's not because Apple is being mean to you or being cheap. I just think they didn't have a way to do this because this was never designed to be a Mac chip. And people think that manifests like, oh, it was never designed to be a Mac chip. Its performance will be bad. It's not the performance. It's stuff like this, like how many ports can you support? How many external displays? Because those are not important things for a phone that has one hole in the bottom of it and generally doesn't spend a lot of time hooked up to external displays. So it is what it is. Headphone port, it does have that. Doesn't support high impedance headphones like the MacBook Air does. Again, no MagSafe.
Also, the headphone port placement is a little odd. It's back on the wrong side. It's back on the left, and also it's really far down. Like it's very close to your wrist.
Like. I mean, the speakers are weird too. The speakers are side firing, and they're towards the front.
Yeah, they're also they're right there too. It's So I think what we are seeing here with some of these decisions is like, you know, Apple went all out designing this from scratch to be significantly less money. And there's all this stuff like, you know, like case design that we don't even really think about as like possible ways to save weight because we don't know how to manufacture this kind of stuff. But there's all sorts of little details like this that are like different or missing or a little bit off. And, you know, it all adds up. But yeah,
I wonder if
too.
The side firing speaker is like because if you're going to like. If you're going to save money on the speakers, maybe use fewer speakers, lower quality speakers, but having them be side-firing and towards you to like sort of bounce off the surface, I feel like the placement is very intentional to essentially make the speakers sound better. Like, if we're going to use these speakers and we're going to put them in this laptop, actually shooting them out of the sides from the front is the best way to do it, because if we had put them like facing up and bouncing off the screen or whatever, they wouldn't sound as good. Like, I'm guessing this is very intentional. And is actually the best place to put these speakers, which are presumably less expensive and fewer speakers.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see, because like I got out my old M2 MacBook Air here, and I'm pretty sure it fires speakers at the screen hinge, right? Like out of the screen hinge towards the screen.
Yeah, I think so.
But like one of the major differences between the MacBook Air and the 14-inch MacBook Pro is the much better speakers you get in the MacBook Pro. It's like it's such a difference, and I wonder like. Are the like from the reviewers that were there at Apple's event today? So
you
far,
can't hear anything in that room?
Yeah, but so far the impression is the speakers are decent. You know, like for what they are.
Yeah, I think the comparison is like compared to the speakers you would get in a similarly placed PC laptop, they're better.
You know, I wonder if maybe because like if you think about like the arrangement inside of these, maybe that's one of the things they were able to do with a smaller battery is move the speakers into the wrist rest, because before like the battery would be under that entire palm rest area.
No, the batteries are pretty, the speakers are pretty skinny, like in the iFixit teardowns, like even the MacBook Pro, they're skinny. I don't know, we'll have to wait to see when people tear this down, but what I'm guessing is like, again, because I don't think there's the room is that tight in there because they did make the battery smaller. I'm guessing this layout is very intentional and other positions would be worse. But
oh, by the way, a real-time follow-up from Mr. Palmer in the chat, who says, I thought the left side was the correct side for the headphone jack. That is true. I got it wrong. I was looking at my MacBook Air, which has it wrong.
Oh, you got it flipped around.
Yeah. The left side is indeed the correct side for the headphone. So
is the headphone jack up? I got to actually look at this. Is the headphone jack more towards the front of the laptop as well than you would expect?
Yeah, it's like it's by your wrists. It's right next to the speaker, which is unusual.
And that's not bad because, you know, that's where you are. But I don't know. Maybe it'll get in the way. We'll see. External displays is just one at 4K. DisplayPort 1.4. And Gruber says, if you plug in an external display and you put it in the wrong USB port, you get a software notification telling you to plug it in the other one. Because basically, if say you've got a 4K display and you're going to plug it in, the two ports are not the same. You cannot plug a 4K display into a USB 2.0 port, right? So if you do plug it in there, the OS says, yeah, that's not the right one. Put it in the other one. I don't think they're labeled in any way. They look identical. It's just one of them is the fast one, one of them is the slow one. Connectivity, this does not get the N1. It has Wi-Fi 6E and Bluetooth 6, so the standards are, you know, fine. It's not Wi-Fi 7, but whatever. But it is Bluetooth 6. I think they use, like, a MediaTek chip or something. It's not Apple's N1 in there. Again, saving money, because whatever chip they use is presumably cheaper than the M1. The camera is 1080. No center stage or desk view. Also, no indicator light on the camera. It's a little green light that, you know, turns on next to the camera when the camera's recording. Instead, they're just relying entirely on the software thing. Hmm. The little, you know, FaceTime-ish icon that appears in your menu bar when it's going on.
That's a weird
one. I don't know
what
the security implications of that, because Apple used to brag about how there's no way in software you can disable the green light. Obviously, there's definitely a way in software where you can disable the thing in the menu bar, I would presume, although maybe system integrity protection and all sorts of stuff tries to stop that, but we'll see. Sound, again, dual speakers, dual mic array instead of three mics from the MacBook Air. Does not support spatial audio with dynamic head tracking on AirPods, which is fine with me because I hate that feature.
Yeah, I was going to say, can I turn that off like universally across all of my devices?
Turn it off. The battery, as Marco said, is 36.5, which is 32% smaller than the MacBook Air's 53.8. So that is a big because again, this is the same size computer and there's essentially a third less battery in it. So that is big. And why is there a third less battery in it? A, because it seems like they could for power, and B, smaller batteries cost less money. I mean, yeah. That's what it comes down to. Like,
and
comes down
and
to.
If the theory about like a thicker case is correct, maybe they actually just didn't have room for a bigger battery.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, if it's thicker, it could be like millimeters, but we'll see. We'll see what it looks like when they tear it down. Up to 16 hours of video streaming, which is 11% less than the MacBook Air, and up to 11 hours of wireless web, which is 26% less than the MacBook Air. So it does take a battery life hit in exchange for that one-third smaller battery, but the battery life still seems acceptable. So 16 hours for video streaming and 11 hours for wireless web. It is fine. But again, if you were hoping this was going to be either an ultra-thin laptop or a laptop that had insane battery life because it uses a phone chip, neither one of those things are true. What is true is that it doesn't cost a lot of money, which we'll get to in a bit. Charging, it comes with a 20-watt charger, which should tell you, don't expect fast charging of this because it doesn't support it. So that 20-watt charger will supply power to this thing as fast as it is willing to take it. So don't bother trying to get a higher wattage charger. It seems like it's not going to charge it any faster. Again, cost savings. No keyboard backlight. No Touch ID on the model, or the base model. If you want Touch ID, you have to check the only option you have, aside from color, which we'll get to in a little bit, which is 512 gig SSD. So if you get the base model, 256 gig SSD, no Touch ID. And as Apple says, lock and wake your screen and power your laptop on and off with the lock key. You know where the Touch ID key is on the keyboard? Now there's just a regular key there with a lock on it. And as many people pointed out, if you're buying these for schools, for example, Touch ID is pointless in schools for the most part, unless it's a one-to-one program, and even then I don't think the kids are going to register their fingerprints or whatever. So it is not unreasonable to lack Touch ID. As someone who's sitting in front of a computer that right now that does not have Touch ID, I tell you, it is possible to use a Mac without Touch ID. It does work.
Yeah, it's miserable though.
Well, you know, anyway, for if you want the basest of base models, the 256 gig version of this MacBook Neo, you do not get Touch ID. Why? Because it saves money. The trackpad. It is not a haptic trackpad. The trackpad actually moves. So we're going back in time. You can still, supposedly, according to Apple, click anywhere on its surface. I'm not sure how that works. I've seen video of people pressing it. It does indeed move, like in the olden days when the trackpads used to move when you press them. And like on a lot of PC laptops, they still move. Does it move like a diving board? Does it move like a trampoline? Does it move like an elevator? I don't know how it moves. We'll have to wait for people to get these to, you know, review them. I've seen people say that it also doesn't support Force Touch. I'm not sure what they mean. Did they just mean that it is a physically moving trackpad?
Yeah, because 3D Touch doesn't exist anymore, right?
Where you press hard and it knows that you're pressing harder?
Yeah, I think that's what they mean, is that you can't press through. You know how... Well, you're not a trackpad person.
But you can still do that on a Mac? I thought that ended years ago.
I thought they got rid of that, but I'm not sure.
No. On a Mac, that's absolutely still possible.
What is that bound to by default? Is it like dictionary lookup or something?
On Words, it's a dictionary lookup. I forget what it is in other places, but yes, I'm doing it right now. You know.
Anyway, this don't have it.
All right. So the colors: silver, blush, citrus, indigo. They're color coordinated keyboard and feet. Jason, who is, by his own admission, relatively colorblind, says blush is pink enough that even I, a person who has a hard time seeing pinks, can tell you it's pink. Indigo is sort of like the MacBook Air's midnight color, lightened up a few notches, and citrus is a bright yellow gold that nobody is going to mistake for some other Apple laptop.
Yeah, I think this is a pretty nice looking color setup for this. Like, it's not super bold, it's not super varied. I think they should have been even more, like, made an even bigger statement and not even offered it in silver. I think it should have just been only colors.
You gotta offer a silver one.
I think
they missed out on is there's no green. That's my disappointment. But, you know, the colors are visible to the naked eye, even from a colorblind person. So we have to say thumbs up on that.
It is kind of funny, like, if you configure if you go into, like, the MacBook Compare specs page on their website, and you set up, like, a MacBook Neo, a MacBook Pro, and a MacBook Air as the three, like, you know, and you put them in price order. It almost looks like you have them in the reverse order for how nice these computers are. Because it's like, you know, if you look at, like, cars, you know, the really, really cheap car model of a model line is, like, only available in white. Right? And then, like, you know, you go a little bit higher and it's like, okay, you can get a few more colors here. And then, like, you go to, like, the luxury cars, you get a lot of color options there. The MacBook lineup is the opposite. Like, the nicer the Mac computer is, the fewer color options you have.
Yeah, maybe they'll learn the iPhone 16 Pro orange lesson, but not for these, because it would be too late to learn for these. But yeah, and the color-coordinated keyboards and feet, like, it's kind of hard to tell in the pictures, because as people point out, like, white balance adjusting of your eyes-wise, you're like, well, all the keyboards are white, aren't they? They're not. The pink laptop has a pink keyboard. The citrus or yellowish citrus laptop has a citrus keyboard. It's easier to tell on the Indigo one, because that's very dark, and you can see that it has a darker keyboard. But and also the rubber feet that are on the bottom, they're not black. All the rubber feet on the MacBook Airs and the MacBook Pros are black. These are color coordinated, so they match. So that's a nice touch. That's where some of the money went. And as Jason Snell points out, the Apple logo on the back of the screen is not a shiny logo, but it's like embossed, like inset. And the shiny logos, the way those are done, and Apple talks about this a lot in their videos, I believe even for the MacBook Air, are they cut out an Apple logo shape, and then they sort of inset, like wood inlay, a different material, that shiny thing, is inlaid into there, and they have to make it, obviously, like a wood inlay. You have to exactly match the hole to the thing you're putting in the hole, so it's seamless, so you don't see a gap around any part of it.
Oh, my God.
And that's
God.
Hard to do, and they do it.
That's
like the
how they make that?
Yeah, I don't know if I knew that.
I don't know if they do that in all the models or just some of them, but I remember they had a video about it, because what they have to do, like, they're, you know, obviously when you manufacture things, there are variances. So what they do is they punch out the Apple logo-shaped holes, and then they have the shiny Apple logos that are going into them, and there's variability, and they essentially have to match up pairs. Like, okay, this hole exactly matches this particular logo.
Oh, my God.
You know, like, because that's what you have to do, because there are tolerances, and they want them to fit exactly. And it's not like so you just have, you get a distribution curve of the holes, and you get a distribution curve of the inserts, and then you just match them up. And that is time consuming and expensive. You want to save money on a laptop? Don't do that. Just carve away a little bit of material, and there's your Apple logo. And that's why these are not shiny, but are instead inset. I would assume that is a cost saving measure, and not so much the cost of the shiny insert, but the cost of, like, the time and labor to do that expensive. And it's computer control, like the matching, it's not humans like holding it up and trying to put it in or whatever, but like, that's expensive. So that's where they save some money here.
That's
I also wanted
great.
To quickly I wanted to quickly note that the 4-minute announcement video for this I thought was really fun and really well done. It's worth 4 minutes of your time to watch. We'll put a link in the show notes. And it shows all the different colors really well, and the way they like edited it with the VFX and stuff. I thought it was really cool. So you should check it out.
Yeah. And environment on this one, 60% recycled content, the highest percentage of any Apple product, 90% recycled aluminum, 100% recycled cobalt in the battery, 45% renewable energy across the supply chain. And as we alluded to before, price $599 for the 256 no touch ID model, or $499 for education. And for the one with touch ID and a 512 gig SSD, it's $699. Those prices are lower than some people expected, but like, when we have that big long session of like, where can you remove price from this thing? They removed it every possible place they could. Places we didn't even think of. Like, did you think removing the indicator light from the camera? Apparently that saves money, because you don't have to deal with that circuitry. You don't have another light. Removing Touch ID, but only from some of the models. I don't think we would have guessed that. But in hindsight, it makes some sense, because in some contexts, you don't need Touch ID, or you don't want it, or it's not important. Yeah, they just removed it everywhere. Like, no backlight on the keyboards. Like, just everything they could, you know, just... They didn't just get it from one big place. Because, again, the SoC, like, how much cheaper... We talked about this before. How much cheaper is an A18 Pro than an M1? I don't know. $30 cheaper? Like, it's not that much cheaper. You need to get the cost from everywhere. And they got it from everywhere. And I think, unlike the 16E, the cost they removed here, I think they did a good job of spreading that around, such that there is no one aspect of this that where you say, like, this makes it a garbage laptop. The closest I would come to say is the one that may be regretful is the trackpad. And maybe that saved them a lot of money, but that really feels like Apple probably was like, oh, I wish we didn't have to do this, because, you know, the niceness of the trackpads is one of the defining characteristics of an Apple laptop. It just feels so nice. It works so well. And it's not like the, you know, they haven't always had haptic ones, but this is kind of like the 32 to 27 inch regression. It's like, we're going to go back in time a little bit to a day when we didn't have haptic trackpads, which means that, again, when you click on it, it opens up a little gap, and maybe a crumb from your scone falls onto the trackpad and it goes in. Like, what I mean? Like, having it not move is actually a pretty big boon. I do wonder how many people are going to be taking these apart and finding crumbs in that part of the computer. I mean, I bet they're used to finding them under the keyboard, but now they're going to be under the trackpad too, because it opens up a little crack when you click it or whatever. That's the only thing I can really fault these things on. And obviously the limitations inherent in the A18 Pro, which I'm not going to say isn't Apple's fault because they made this computer, but it's not Apple making poor decisions about what to put into a product. It's Apple of the past not having the foresight to realize they needed a chip to go into a low-end laptop, right? But that it is what it is. So be aware that some of the limitations of this are to blame on the A18 Pro, and there's nothing Apple could really do about it short of not rolling out this computer until it has an A19 or A20 or something with fewer limitations. But I think this is pretty good, but I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think this is a really solid computer for people who don't care about computers. And I think that comes across very dismissive, and I don't mean it that way at all. For us, for the three of us, and for probably anyone listening to the show, we care a lot about computers. We want nice computers. We want fast computers. And this is not those things, and that's okay. And I think, like you had said, John, most of the trade-offs they made, I think, make a lot of sense. It would bum me out to have this computer as a primary computer, but I tell you what, as a like downstairs computer, which is currently an M2 iPad Pro for me, this would fit the bill pretty nicely. And if you price out an a modern iPad Pro with keyboard, because for me, I would want that, it's like two or three times the price. Well, yeah, I guess
you could have one of these in each room.
Right. I mean, you wouldn't have to have an iPad Pro, to be fair, but to have an iPad with a nice keyboard, with a cantilevered keyboard, the keyboard alone is like $400. Somebody said this.
Yeah, $350, I think.
Something
it's
like
ridiculous.
That.
It's like, yeah, an iPad keyboard is $350, and this
whole-ass computer is $600.
Yeah, I believe that. I think it was at the bottom of Gruber's post, too. Like, just like what you get for this shows how bad of a value the iPad Pro and Magic Keyboard are by comparison.
Yeah.
Well, the iPad Pro is actually not that bad of a deal because it has a really good, it's just over-provisioned. It has a really good screen.
Less so on the iPad Pro, much more so on the Magic Keyboard.
Keyboard is definitely like, yeah, that's hard to justify. I think that, I do wonder why those cost so much. Maybe it's like low volumes or whatever, but yeah, that doesn't have a lot of computing power in the keyboard, and it's just plastic. It's not even like they're super durable, because at various times, the iPad keyboards have like fallen apart after several years, so that's a tough problem.
By the way, for the record, some follow-up on myself in the past. I said, I believe last episode, I was saying how the 11-inch iPad Pro with keyboard, with the Magic Keyboard, I thought it might be heavier than the MacBook Air, and I have them both, and I weighed them both, and it is, for the record. So
doesn't surprise me. They always feel heavy when I pick them up.
Yes. Anyway,
right, so here's the real comparison to think about this, because Apple is rolling out this line of low cost laptops in fun colors. They're trying to go down market. We feel like we can field the laptop at a lower price that is still a good product, and here it is, and it's called the Neo. What about the Neo versus the Walmart M1 MacBook Air, which they have been selling for many years now? It's a MacBook Air that was sold through Walmart for $650, and it's just the M1 MacBook Air as it existed. They just, you know, they gave it to Walmart to sell when they stopped sort of selling it themselves. Here are some comparisons. Here are the ways in which the Neo is better than the M1 MacBook Air. It is 30% faster in single core and about the same in multi-core and GPU. It has a 100 nit brighter screen. It has 1 hour better battery life. It has Wi-Fi 6E instead of 6. It has Bluetooth 6 instead of 5. Its camera is 1080 instead of 720. It is $50 cheaper than the Walmart one for the 256 gig model, and you can actually buy it and it's in stock. Those are the Neo advantages. What are the M1 MacBook Air advantages?
Also, I'd say you can buy the Neo anywhere, like, because Apple will sell it directly to you.
Yeah, you don't have to buy
it
at Walmart. But like, even at Walmart, sometimes it's not always in stock. So I don't know what the future of the M1 MacBook Air is. I think maybe they're just going to sell through them, because Walmart will be selling the Neo. So
I can't imagine the M1 MacBook Air sticks around after this.
Yeah, maybe they just sell through them. But anyway, here are the M1 MacBook Air advantages over the Neo. M1 MacBook Air has Touch ID on every model. It supports P3 color. It has True Tone with an ambient light sensor. Its screen is 0.3 inches bigger diagonally, and it has about 500,000 more pixels than the Neo. It has two Thunderbolt 4 USB 4 ports, because it is indeed a Mac. It has a 3 micro array instead of 2. It has a little light on the camera. It has a haptic trackpad, and it has a backlit keyboard. So you really see that, like, the MacBook Air was never designed to be the Walmart bargain basement model. It's just that they took what was essentially the best MacBook Air that they had ever introduced when the M1 came out, and they just kept selling it forever because it was just so darn good. But, like, it's like when Casey goes shopping for used cars. If you want to buy a new car for $45,000, it's not going to have all the same features as a massively depreciated EV for multiple years old. And you can tell, like, when you look at the M1 MacBook Air, like, oh, this wasn't a bargain computer when it was new. It just is now. And it was always designed to be a Mac. Again, the biggest thing is, like, 2 Thunderbolt 4 ports versus USB 3 and USB 2. That is a big difference in terms of bandwidth and usability if you care about the ports. P3, why would this have P3 color? Is it a Walmart laptop? Well, it wasn't always a Walmart laptop. When it was introduced, having P3 color was table stakes for what was then the highest-end MacBook Air ever made. Same thing with Touch ID. It's across all the models. But time marches on. That's why the Neo has a better camera than this thing does, right? And the Neo is $50 cheaper if you care about that. The Neo has better Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. The Neo has better battery life, a brighter screen, faster single-core SoC. So, like, it's not a slam dunk in either direction. It depends on what of those things you care about. Oh, and by the way, I should list this as a pro in the Neo. It comes in fun colors. And the MacBook Air does not.
Also, I think one thing to not underestimate is when the MacBook Air went from the M1 to the M2 generation, it had a case redesign.
Yeah, that's right.
And the MacBook Air M2 and forward case feels fantastic. It is delightful to pick up and hold. I think it is a huge tactile upgrade from and aesthetic upgrade from the M1
family. I kind of like the wedge. Like, I see arguments for both because my son has an M2 MacBook Air, my daughter has an M4, so I'm very familiar with the new case, but I also have an M1 MacBook Air sitting here. So, like, I don't know if I would put it as a pro in either one. If you like one case better than another, then be aware that there is that difference. But I do kind of like the wedge in some ways.
Yeah. And to be clear, and, you know, the Neo is not identical to the MacBook Air case. It is a little bit thicker.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a little bit different. It's
but
small.
It's like roughly, it's similar. Yeah,
the biggest difference is, like, it's 13-inch screen versus 13.6. So if you can imagine what difference that would make in a case, like, it is, you know, it is slightly thicker, but not as long and not as wide.
Yeah, but I do think, like, the M1 MacBook Air, it looked old. It felt old. It was old, and I always had that kind of that question in my mind of, like, how long, first of all, how long are they going to be selling this? And then second of all, like, could you tell someone, go buy this 5-year-old computer with, like, what if they, like, stopped supporting the OS next year on it? Or, like, I was always worried about that kind of thing, where, like, this is now a current production model.
Well,
it's a new model.
That's a thing that people worry about with the A18 Pro as well. Like, obviously, it's a concern with the M1, especially since the M1 doesn't have, like, all, like, the more advanced neural engines and various other things in the GPU cores and crap like that. But people are worried already about the A18 Pro. They're like, how long will Mac OS support the A18 Pro? Because even though it is a newly introduced computer, it is an older chip and it's not really designed to be a Mac chip. So, like, what does the longevity look like? Like, not that it's going to ever get too slow, but, like, is there going to be, like, 2 versions of Mac OS from now? They're going to be like, oh yeah, you can't use the A18 Pro with that. Like, I don't know. That's kind of up to Apple how long they want to support this, but it is also a concern on the M1. So the reason I think it's not a slam dunk is, like I said, the M1 is your used luxury car. It's massively depreciated. It's super old. It's no longer state of the art. But when it was new, it had more nice stuff, and it still does have more stuff. I was kind of shocked when I looked this up that the Neo has 1 hour better battery life, because I always think of the M1 as having amazing battery life. But these are just by Apple's measures. I don't know how accurate they are.
Well, the M1's also, again, it's a 5-year-old chip. It's a 5-year-old process.
Several processes old. What is it? 7-nanometer? I forget.
Whatever it is. It's not the latest and greatest in that way. And of course, you've had many efficiency gains in both the physical design of the chip and also, like, the cleverness of the chip. Like, you know, like the efficiency of the cores is higher now, too. Honestly, I think it's awesome. Even though this is not for me. And I think, by the way, for anybody out there thinking, like, should I get this instead of a MacBook Air for my, like, you know, messing around computer? The only thing I would say is, like, there's a lot of little like lacks of niceties that I think you might notice if you are accustomed to other Macs. This is definitely a slam dunk for people who are coming from PCs. But if you're coming from other Macs, the lack of certain things, like if you've always had backlit keyboards and you suddenly don't, like, that kind of thing. But honestly, I think one of the most significant, like, kind of paper cuts that you might face in real life is the lack of the ambient light sensor. Because what that means, you open this thing up no matter where you are, and boom, it blasts you with like whatever your screen setting was when you were in brighter light. When you know, so like I think that you're going to be constantly like riding that screen brightness thing. That actually might be the biggest paper cut for people like in real use. But I think overall, like when you compare this to PCs in the similar price range, people keep saying this is Apple trying to take on Chromebooks. I don't think that's significant.
Chromebooks don't cost $600.
No, and like if you're going to try to tackle Chromebooks in schools, those are like $200 computers. They're garbage. They're disposable. And the appeal of schools getting Chromebooks is largely about cost, but there's also other factors like management that Apple, like, you know, they're all on Google.
Integration with Google's Classroom crap.
Yeah, like there's a lot of other factors that schools like and rely on and are very compelling for them that Apple is never going to match. So
Apple is not mentioning education in the marketing for this product anywhere that I've seen. Like they have education pricing for all their computers, like just because they mentioned it's $500 to education. Like this, their videos are not like, we see children, everyone, every child will have one of these. No, they're just trying to sell it to consumers.
Yeah, exactly. Like they're going to sell it to students. Like, you know, directly, yeah. Like, or, you know, to their parents, like, you know, the people who go to school will buy this or have this bought for them, but not by the school. The school is going to keep doing whatever the school was doing before. I'm sure, you know, like when our kid was when we were living on Fire Island year round during some of the COVID lockdowns, the Fire Island school was very well funded. And so every kid there got a MacBook Air. So like if you were like the kind of school that was already buying Macs for students, I'm sure many of those will switch to these because they're a lot cheaper. Yeah. That's great. But if, you know, for schools that were already buying the $200 Chromebooks, they're not going to these. But anyway, overall, like I think this is going to be very significant. This will significantly expand the Mac's market share over time. You know, the Walmart M1 was an experiment, I think. And as we've discussed, like that was never designed to be a super cheap computer. That was designed to be a medium cheap computer. That was never designed to be a super cheap computer. This is now designed for that. It's, you know, very much like the approach. This is a total shift in strategy. This is very much like the approach Apple took with the iPhone 17e versus the old SEs, which were like regular iPhones that were kind of cut down after the fact with, you know, medium aged and medium sophistication parts. And then, you know, when the 16e came out, that was like the first iPhone that was designed from scratch to be less expensive. And this is the first Mac
5C
that was...
5C would like to raise its hand.
The 5C, that was barely a change from the base model, you know, 5S and 5. Anyway, so this is, wasn't it just a 5 with a plastic case? Like that was the only
change? It wasn't just a 5 with a plastic case, but the plastic case is the whole phone. Like it really was significant redesign for a cheaper phone.
Okay, anyway. So this is a significant strategy shift. This is a significant product that like they weren't just like, we're going to make this thing a few $100 cheaper than the Air. Because, you know, we were all of us, you know, pundits and people, we were like, well, we want it to be like $500 or $600, but there's no way it'll be that cheap. It'll be $700 or $800. And no, it's $600. Like, that's great. And that's, you know, $500 through the educational discount, like that. And over time, I'm sure we'll see these like get, you know, put on sale here and there, $50 off. Oh, this weekend, Costco has it for $100 off. Like, you know, we're going to see that kind of stuff. That's amazing. And this is going to expand the market share of Macs. And for people who would never have considered a Mac when it was $1,000, $1,100, many more of them will consider it at $600 or on sale on Black Friday at $500. Like that's going to be a real thing over time. And this right now, this is probably the most expensive it will ever start. You know, over time, I guess inflation will eventually push this price up. But like, right now, it's $600 to start. Over time, we'll probably see them like push a little further down. This is what we've seen on the low-end iPad as well. Like, you know, it starts out at a certain price, and then like it fluctuates here and there with updates, but over time, it tends to be pushed a little bit downward. And this is great news for people like us who love the Mac, because this means they're going to sell a lot more Macs, especially when you compare this to what we were saying earlier, like an iPad with a keyboard. it's a no-brainer. This is a way better option for most people most of the time. This is what many people will choose. So this is and the Walmart one was kind of like Apple kind of like dumping old stock quietly through some other brand. Like they didn't want to touch it, like brand wise. They didn't want people to know about it really. They just were kind of quietly dumping the stuff over here. Well, now Apple's owning it. So whatever the sales of the Walmart M1 MacBook Air were, which were probably not terrible, but whatever those sales were, it's going to be much more now, because now it's going to be available through every Apple retailer, like all their resellers, all of Apple's own stores and direct channels, their website. Like, they're going to be promoting it. Like the M1 MacBook Air, the Apple never promoted. Apple like wanted that as quiet as possible. This they are loudly promoting. So a lot of people are going to see this. They're making a splash. The colors are making a splash. Yeah, I might pick a few different ones, but hey, you know what? I'm happy. I'm proud of them for doing colors on the Mac that you can actually see. So this is great news. I'm very happy to see this. I think this is the start of something very, very good for the low end of the Mac line. And the only other thing I'll say is I wish they would do a Mac Mini like this. Like a really, really cheap Mac Mini.
That is not quite as mainstream a product. Like, as a lot of Jason has been pointing this out, like the Mac Mini had previously held the crown for the cheapest Mac in terms of absolute dollar numbers, not adjusted for inflation, that Apple has ever sold. But the Mac Mini, if you buy it, you can't actually use it. You have to buy it. It doesn't even come with a mouse and a keyboard, let alone a screen. Like, it is not a complete system. So even though the Mac Mini was the champ, I think it was like $499.
Just selfishly, like, you know, so many people buy Mac Minis for, you know, roles like file servers or, you know, more recently running AI agents or whatever. But like, there's a lot of people who like, if your Mac Mini ran an iPhone chip, it'd be fine. And you know, so like a Mac Mini with these.
Do you want it to come in colors too?
Yes, why not? Give me a weird mustard colored Mac Mini.
Put their Mac Minis where they're not even visible.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I'd buy the neon pink one. Who cares?
I feel like the Neo in Apple stores. I feel like the impression that it's going to give is, first of all, I believe it will be perceived as the smallest laptop because people don't notice a thickness change of 1.5 millimeters, but they do notice length and width-wise. And I know we're like, oh, well, it's a smaller screen, 13-inch versus 13.6, but that makes the laptop physically smaller. And if you're the type of person who's like, I don't want a laptop to take up a lot of space in my life, like you're in the market for something like the Neo anyway, because you're like, I'm not a computer person. I want something small that fits in my backpack. Oh, and they come in fun colors. It will so clearly be the most attractive to you product in the store. Because you're like, why would anybody buy these other computers? They're bigger, they're uglier, and God, have you seen the prices? Doesn't make any sense. Why would anyone buy one? It's like going into a car lot and seeing a cute pink convertible, and that one costs less than all the other cars, and all the other cars are giant silver four-door sedans. You're like, why would anyone buy one of those? Like, it's a cute pink convertible. And like, well, you don't understand. The cute pink convertible has a crappy engine, and like, it doesn't have a lot of space in the trunk. You're just like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't know what any of that stuff means. It's just me and like my backpack, and I want to go off to school, and this is half the price of, I guess it should be a giant silver SUV or something or whatever. Like, for the people who are in the market for this, it's not like they're like, oh, I guess I have to guess this one because it's the cheapest. It's going to be the one they want the most anyway, because it fits their desires the most. Like, that's the thing that, you know, computer nerds don't understand is like, can you imagine someone not only not caring about computer specs, but finding them a detriment and not understanding what anyone would ever pay for that. Like, I just want it to be small and cute and do the stuff that I needed to do. And if you sit there and explain to them, like, the differences that we just went through, like, here are the things that are different between the Neo and the M4 MacBook Air, and you went through all those things, that their eyes would just glaze over. Like, especially if, as you said, Marco, if they're coming from the PC, it's like, they don't, like, even though there is a difference with the haptic trackpad and, like, the ambient light sensor, if they're not used to having a haptic trackpad, and an Apple-quality haptic trackpad and ambient light sensor on their PC laptops, they don't know what they're missing. And so you explaining it to them is not going to be convincing. Now, I do feel like if they eventually, you know, this is the great thing about the Neo and it's the great thing about Chromebooks for Google. If you get kids using a Neo when they're younger, as they become older professionals and maybe like, you know, this is my third Apple laptop, maybe I'll try one of those MacBook Airs. They're going to notice, oh, no, this trackpad is actually a little bit nicer. And oh, having an ambient, they won't know an ambient light sensor is, but like, oh, this one doesn't blast my eyes out. Like, just like getting a bigger screen, you will be you become more accustomed to the better thing. But people could spend years just using the Neo and be perfectly satisfied with it until and unless their needs change or their budgets change. So yeah, I think this is going to be an extremely successful product, assuming there are no gates, I guess, like trackpad gate where all the trackpads break because Apple's not used to making ones that move, or like some crap like that. Like, that's always a wild card out there. But like, you know, going down, like, I think the M1 MacBook Air at Walmart has probably been really successful with Apple, which sort of verified their like desire to do this. Like, okay, we can actually sell this. Let's do it. Let's, as you said, Marco, let's own it. And they are. And I think this will sell incredibly well. And people are asking, like, who is this? Who can use this? I think pretty much any student can use this, unless as part of your like college major or whatever, you need to run demanding local stuff. I was thinking about this for my kids. My daughter could use this in her school. She hasn't actually picked a major yet, but she's probably going to be some major that wouldn't require lots of computing power. My son was a computer science major, and as part of his classes, he had to run VMs on his local machine. And with an 8 gig machine, if you're running like a Linux VM plus running a bunch of Python stuff locally, maybe you're pushing it. Maybe not. Maybe it would be fine. But like him having an M2 MacBook Air, I think, with more RAM, I think did benefit him in his major. I'm not saying he couldn't use it, but I'm saying the M2 MacBook Air was a better fit for his needs. But that's only because he was a computer science major doing computer science crap on his computer. Pretty much anyone else, can you write 4 years worth of papers on this? Yes. Can you browse the web forever on this? Yes. Can you do all your email? Like, it will do all of those things. Because remember, when you're thinking about this, don't think of it as like, oh, it's a laptop with a phone chip. Just thinking of it as the M1 MacBook Air, which used to be the best, most powerful MacBook Air available, and people bought it and loved it and are still buying it today, all these years later. So think of it like that. Don't think of it like, oh, how can I ever use a laptop with a phone chip? Like, I think, you know, and this is the beauty of this, you know, when you see those cost curves of like how much things cost over the past like several decades, it's usually shown to show you the healthcare line. Like, it's inflation-adjusted dollars, like percentage of your annual income. Like, how is the relative price of these things change? College and healthcare in our stupid country are going straight up like a rocket. It's terrible. Like, not in absolute values, but in terms of like how much does it cost relative to how much people make. But the cost of TVs has gone through the floor. Because back when my parents were young, buying a TV was like buying a new car. And now it's like, whatever. Like, I'll get one. I'll impulse buy one at Costco. Because you can get a pretty big flat screen TV for a couple hundred bucks, right? And computing power is like that. And Apple has been slow and reluctant to leverage that. But what's happening, slowly but surely, is, and we've seen it with smartphones, is that the amount of compute needed to do basic web browsing and word processing has just been getting cheaper and cheaper, because the demands of basic web browsing and word processing, although especially web browsing, has increased and has not increased as fast as computing power has increased. And I would argue for like basic word processing and like even like image editing, that is kind of like flatlined, in that most people never need to do any more sophisticated image editing, setting aside AI stuff, which is a whole other thing, than they can do on any recent laptop. And the same thing with text editing. Like, you're typing and spell checking, that's not really changing that much, despite software being sloppier, right? So it behooves Apple and any company to say, you know, as Gruber was pointing out, Apple used to claim, and I think they were correct, they could not make a laptop that met their quality standards at a price point that was competitive with the lowest end of the PC market. They still can't, but the low end of the PC market has gone so far down that there is now room below the MacBook Air for another computer. And I would say that, you know, the Apple of old that was more premium might say, oh, the Neo doesn't quite meet our quality standards. But like, you could see someone arguing, saying, yeah, but it's really close, right? And it's still nicer than the PC laptop, so we should ship it. And so there's no one there to say, no, I'm never going to ship a Mac without an ambient light sensor and a haptic trackpad now that those things exist. But I mean, if whoever that was who was doing that, whether it was Steve Jobs or somebody else, they're no longer at Apple. Today's Apple is correctly, I think, deciding to take advantage of essentially the dividend of computing power outpacing a lot of common tasks, and go down market with the Mac, and I think they're going to sell a lot of them. I think it's a good idea.
I think even beyond that, like, you know, the framing of it as like, you know, can people get away with just a phone chip for their computer? Like, I think the world has changed a lot in recent years, and one of the realities that many people like us maybe fail to see or appreciate fully is that for most people, their phone is their main computer, or their primary, you know, or their best computer, or their
and
most.
And might
computer.
Have more pixels than this computer anyway,
right? And And so, like, what computing has become these days is basically what can people do on their phones. And instead of thinking about this as, like, a cut-down computer, you know, with settling for a phone chip, think of it as, like, it's a phone with a keyboard, trackpad, and big screen.
And that's a giant battery.
Yeah, exactly. And that's and that's going to be wonderful, like, because that actually is what most people need and use. And then also, with things moving so much into, like, cloud-based AI computing, powering all the, like, where the cutting-edge stuff is right now, we're back in the era of thin clients. We're back in the era of, like, the local computing power being a lot less relevant than it used to be, or at least maybe, like, where the exciting things are in computing right now are not happening with a lot of local resource processing.
Because no one has a local computer with that much RAM. Like, you know, you can have, like, you know, hundreds of gigs of RAM or whatever. Like, just the compute needed to do the current hot thing, which is AI, that just doesn't exist. Doesn't exist on a desktop. Doesn't exist on a laptop. Certainly doesn't. Like, it's just not feasible. That's, you know, there are lots of useful local models, and Apple does run them, and they do useful things, but the bleeding edge is so outside the realm of a battery-powered laptop currently, that it's all server-side. And your point about thin clients is true, although I did see a thread recently of someone describing how the Claude terminal command line application works and showing the usage, the resource usage of it. In theory, there's no reason that a thin client that uses a terminal input that just has a text, you know, cursor-style text display, that should be able to be incredibly thin, because it's just like, I send text to the server, I get text back. If the server's doing all the work, I should be both fast and low resource usage. But the stats they showed were not low, because they have found this very convoluted way to do a command line application. No, they're not using the well, maybe they are using the Cursus library, but they're like, they're running a React app behind the scene and rendering to a 2D backing buffer and pixel diffing it, and then, like, sending, like, to a terminal escape sequences to, like, anyway, the point is they were showing, like, gigs of memory usage for what is essentially a Node.js app or whatever language it's written in that just sends HTTP requests to a server and gets responses and spits them. Because we've all used it. Like, it's a text. It's a terminal application. It is not a GUI, and yet it uses huge resources. So while in theory and technically you are correct, I'm not sure current software practices are taking full advantage of the thinness of the client right now.
Well, but, you know, but what most people's experience with AI is a web browser.
Yeah,
you know, they're going to ChatGPT.com and, or, you know, or using there are other, you know, other browser based
things.
Yeah,
they're not using coding agents or whatever.
Yeah, and or they're like, you know, even people who will be using coding agents. Oh, by the way, Xcode's coding agent support does not work with 8 gigs of RAM, as Steve Trenton Smith pointed out today.
But the command line Claude executable or code executable does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can run the Codex app also. Like, Codex has a GUI app, which I've actually been using, and it does pretty much what the Xcode thing does, but I think honestly a little bit better. Anyway. So I think this is great, and it is not the 12-inch MacBook replacement that nerds like us were kind of wishing for, but also that was never really rumored for this release. This was always rumored to be a lower-cost 13-inch MacBook of some kind, and they delivered. Possibly, you know, none of us have this thing yet, but it sure looks like they delivered really well on that product brief. And I think it's going to be good for Mac.
One more thing. So this is also a cost-saving thing, obviously, because, you know, everything is about cost-saving with this thing. But there's two options, 256 or 512. Like, those are your only choice. And color. There's color and 256 or 512. And obviously that saves costs, because you don't need to make lots of variety of these, although Apple does have to make the colors and whatever ratios. They have to kind of guess about that. But the really important thing about that is someone who doesn't care about computer specs now does not have a million decisions to make to buy this. They just pick the color they want, and then there's the cheap one and the expensive one. Even if they don't know the differences between the cheap one and the expensive one, if they don't care, they're going to get the cheap one. Like, there's literally one choice besides color, and that choice is $100 difference, and I think people can just pick that based, like, oh, if they say, why is this $100 more, you start talking about it, and they're like, oh, never mind, I'll just have that other one. Or they're like, oh, I like the touch thing, I guess I have to get the marks. But that's it. Those are the only options on this computer, which is incredibly smart. Even if Apple didn't do it for these reasons, and they just did it for cost, it is going to make this computer the easiest Mac to buy, because you have to make fewer decisions.
Yep. You put together the $600 family of iPhone device, or excuse me, of Apple devices. The iPhone 17e is $600. The iPad Air with M4 is $600. And the MacBook Neo is $600.
And that is a tiny phone, a medium-sized tablet, and a kind of small laptop. All cost the same price. And that's a testament to Apple's, you know, sort of spreading their products across the entire range of shapes and sizes that it costs, and also a testament to Apple finally bringing the Mac down, not to the lowest of the low, because the plain iPad is cheaper than the iPad Air, obviously, and the iPhone 17e, I don't think, is the cheapest phone, because you can still buy, like, older models for less, maybe, but, like, if you have $600 to spend, you can get a phone, an iPad, or a Mac, and all of those products that we've listed here are all new, newly released this week, and are all pretty good.
Good deal.
All right.
All right.
Thanks to our sponsors this episode, Factor, Delete Me, and Masterclass, and thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of ATP membership is Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. Every week, we have one additional bonus topic. It runs about 15, 20 minutes. Sorry, John. And it's extra topics, extra things that we couldn't get to in our regular outline. This week in Overtime, we're talking about Apple's new video podcast support in Apple Podcasts, which is, I think, pretty interesting for those of us in the podcast business, or people who listen to podcasts or watch podcasts, which is probably most of you. So here you can tune in, hv.fm/join, to hear Overtime and get all of our other membership perks. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.
I think this is you, John.
I can do mine, I guess. It's shorter.
Yes.
Perfect.
Shorter is better for this. Yeah.
So this was late breaking right before we recorded. I had a post break containment. Do you know what that phrase means?
Like go viral?
Well, get outside your like normal audience would be how I would take it.
Yeah. So there's two phrases here. One is break containment, which is what Casey basically said, which is like, so you're on social media or a blog or whatever, it's some kind of platform where you publish things that are visible to the world. And breaking containment means you publish something, a blog post, a tweet on Mastodon, whatever, and it got passed around outside the normal circle of people who watch your stuff. So if you're on social media, like on Mastodon, you have people who follow you and they see the things that you toot. Breaking containment means enough people retweeted it or whatever that now people who have no idea who you are and do not follow you and don't know anything about you start to see this post because it was popular enough. And it doesn't take much. Like, this wasn't a very popular post. It was like barely more popular than my average post, but it was just popular enough. Like, if you did the graph of this, it's like breaking containment. Yeah. You ever see those graphs of like who's connected to who in a social network? There's like these little clusters, like little cities where it's like, well, here's all these people and they're mostly connected to each other. But then there are these bridges to these other circles to like, you know, I don't know what Mastodon look like, but like the Linux people over here and the Apple people over here and like whatever groups they're divided up into, you know, the people in the US here and then the Europeans here and then like the soccer fans here and then like just all these different little circles. And it only takes like the right few people to like retweet something to cross from one of those clusters to another, that all of a sudden a bunch of people who don't normally see your stuff are seeing your stuff. And then the second phrase is context collapse, which we'll link to the Wikipedia page with specifically the definition in social media, which is, I gotta look at the Wikipedia, but my definition of it is like, it's kind of like the same as breaking containment in that you're writing something with the expectation that the audience that's seeing it, like you think you know what audience you're speaking to. But when something breaks containment, it's not actually true. Let's see what we can see from the Wikipedia page. Their definition is not great. Anyway, we'll link to it and you can look it up. But basically what it comes down to is people are seeing your stuff and they don't have the context that the normal people who follow you do. For example, they don't know who you are. They don't know that you're on a podcast where you just talked about the thing that you tweeted about or whatever. They don't know that you're an Apple fan. They don't know that you live in the United States. They don't know your political persuasion or whatever. All they see is the thing that you wrote that arrives into their world. And so I experienced both of these just before we came to the show. And it was for this tweet that I did. I mean, I mostly spend my time on Mastodon, but I do occasionally also post things to Blue Sky just to see what the difference is. And often I usually have to edit it because Blue Sky's limit is lower than my Mastodon server, so I have to squish things down a little bit. But like, the post was what I just said in the program. That was the A18 Pro and the MacBook Neo is 19% faster than the M2 Ultra and the Mac Pro in single core performance. A MacBook Neo is $600. The Mac Pro, which is still for sale, is $7,000. Anyone who listens to the show or knows me gets that toot, which is like, isn't it absurd that they're still selling the Mac Pro with an M2 Ultra in it, that they're still selling it for $7,000 when the MacBook Neo, the super duper low cost, cheapest Mac, blah, 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 is 19% faster in single core than the Mac Pro. This is a post of me slamming them. What I'm trying to do is shame Apple into canceling the Mac Pro because it's embarrassing at this point. Like, it
oh, is
stop.
That what you want?
Yes. Stop. Like, they need to poop or get off the pot, as they say. Like, it's just, are we doing this or are we not? Because it's like when the trash can was still there. It's like, I do want a new Mac Pro, but at a certain point, it's just embarrassing. You got to stop selling the trash can for the same price that you've always sold it for. And the Apple's like, nope, we're gonna sell it till the day it gets replaced or something else happens. So anyway, you know, my audience saw this and was like, oh, John complaining about the Mac Pro again. It is kind of embarrassing that it's still got the M2 Ultra. And it is, you know, I'm usually making fun of my Intel Mac Pro, which is, you know, horrendously slow by modern standards. But this is the current Mac Pro that you can buy at Apple.com today. They're still selling it with a straight face. And the MacBook Neo is statistically significantly faster in single core. Now, as I said in the specs of the show, it is smaller, slower in multi-core than the M2 Ultra. GPU is way slower than the M2 Ultra. The M2 Ultra has way more memory bandwidth. The M2 Mac Pro can be filled with way more RAM. Yada, yada, yada. But anyway, like, I don't have to explain this to quote-unquote my audience on Mastodon because they all know my attitude towards the Mac Pro. They all know what the point of this post was. They all know it's meant in jest. Ha, isn't this funny? It's absurd to think about these type of things. No one who follows me, they're aware of the situation with the Mac Pro and my opinion on it. And if to the extent that they care about the Mac Pro at all, it's probably only as a proxy through me because they never think about it otherwise. Because why would they? So that's the toot. But when something breaks containment and has context collapse, people start responding to it in ways that you will find puzzling. First one that I found puzzling that I was like, did I make a mistake or something? I got a couple of people replying, telling me, oh, you got the price wrong. It's $1,700.
What?
What? And like the first time someone did it, I'm like, I just sent them the link to the MacBook Neo page. It was like, the product just came out. They don't, you know, if you're not like a Mac person, you don't know that the MacBook Neo came out today. Why would you? Right. But, like, I did say MacBook Neo. I'm like, did I spell it incorrectly? No, I spelled it correctly in the post. It's in there two times. But, like, if you read fast, you see MacBook, three-letter word, you think MacBook Pro. So, and then it happened again, and someone said, the MacBook Pro is $1,700, dude. Look, you got the price totally wrong. I don't know what you're talking about.
Like, did people just think that MacBook Neo was, like, you just saying, like, the new MacBook?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, is it just, you know, it's an anagram of MacBook One, but it looks a lot like PRO. It's got a tall letter and then two lowercase letters. So there's that. So then you're like, that's how you
could
tell
it be like a translation thing. Like, if something auto translated it as the new MacBook.
These were also English speakers as far as, but like, that's breaking containment. Like, yeah. People who follow me probably knew the MacBook Neo came out today. People who have no idea who I am or anything about Apple or anything have no idea what the MacBook Neo came out an hour ago. How would they know, right? Second thing is context collapse, where a bunch of people were real angry, thinking that what I was saying is you should buy a MacBook Neo instead of a Mac Pro because it's more powerful. Like, as if this post was like bragging about how powerful the MacBook Neo is. It's the opposite. I'm using the MacBook Neo to show how pathetic the Mac Pro is. That, I mean, again, you both get this. Like, that's the point of the post is the MacBook Pro is embarrassing. What I'm not saying is the MacBook Neo just came out and it's more powerful than the Apple's most powerful computer. A, Apple's most powerful computer is not the Mac Pro, and B, no way in hell am I saying that. But context collapses, you need a lot of context to take this post in the way that I meant it. You need to know my deal, that I'm on an Apple podcast. You need to know my Mac Pro enthusiasm, which you would never guess because who is a Mac Pro enthusiast, right? You need to know so much about me before you can interpret this toot the right way. And lots of people were complaining about both of these things, both breaking containment, which is a little bit more modern phrase, and context collapse in the good old bad old days of Twitter, because it was a problem for people who actually had popular posts. Like, mine was not popular. Got like, you know, what is it like? I don't know. 100 retweets, but the people would get like 100,000 retweets, and that basically destroyed, we used to destroy Twitter for you. Because once people who have no idea who you are seeing it, and there's thousands of them, everyone's going to be mad about everything. So in this case, like the number of people who were so mad about this, first of all, people would not believe that it's 19% faster in single core, but then they would say like, well, it's certainly, you know, got to be slower in multi-core. I made the mistake of responding to one person and saying that it is actually similar to the M1 in multi-core, and they got super angry about that too. It's like, whatever. Like, but that's not the, I'm not, you know, that's not the point of the post. So anyway, I thought this was a good short instructive after show to just let people, you know, people who are not familiar with the phenomenon, which is probably young people, like, this is a thing that can happen to anybody. If something you write online or post online, some Instagram thing or whatever, breaks containment out of your little circle, you'll know it because you'll start to get replies from people that are different than what you've been seeing. Not necessarily worse or more hostile, but just like that seem confusing to you because they evidence a misunderstanding of your deal. And it's because they don't know what your deal is because they don't have any context. Yeah. And so that's the thing that still happens. I'm so not used to it happening to me. Like, this is why I talk about the cross-posting to Mastodon and BlueStyle. The reason I do that is I try to gauge like, where do I get more like people actually responding to my stuff? Like, where is my audience actually? I prefer Mastodon. I primarily use Mastodon. It's the horse I'm backing. I like it the best. I like the clients the best. I like everything about it. But I'm always like, well, Blue Sky is like 10 bazillion times bigger, and lots of people seem to like it over there, and I do read stuff over there. What is it like if I post over there? And I can tell you, for my tiny, weird audience, Mastodon is still where my people are. I get the most engagement from Mastodon. I get the most good info from Mastodon. I get the most replies. People understand my deal on Mastodon. It's where my people are. But Mastodon is a tiny little backwater compared to the size of Blue Sky or Threads or obviously X, which I'm not going near. But yeah, I do post it over there just to check and just to see if people are going to engage with things and what kind of things are, you know, work in different places. But yeah, breaking containment, it's still a danger. It's still a thing that can happen, and it's still for me usually not particularly fun, but it's also not particularly dangerous. That would have been much worse for me if I was anyone other than, you know, an old white dude in tech. Because breaking containment for me is just people making snarky replies versus people like coming to my house to kill me or whatever. So thank goodness for that. But yeah, that was my afternoon, and it was a reminder that internet gonna internet.
It's very true. Titles.
All right, we are running so long. Oh my god. Okay,
I'm gonna die, but it's fine.
Yeah.
It's a little risque, but I like all of its cool holes. And even though that's an XDR,
we just did a hole based one, didn't we? We had holes in the cheese.
And
yeah,
I like.
I mean,
the
I'm
good
not saying
port.
It has to be the winner.
No one else except me likes the good port, but I like the good port.
Where is that one?
It's in the ones. Port. I'm the one.
The good port.
Because I do vote.
Are you going for like
titles.
The good wife, or what's the reference?
Oh,
like
there? The good place. I don't know. I thought it was funny.
Oh, the good place. Yeah. Where is that?
It's in the ones.
It's about to be a two. That's pretty it's good.
Not. I do like the price of your nightmares.
Actually, that is pretty good.
Because it has a double meaning. Is like, it is the price of your nightmares, as in it's a nightmarish price, but it is also like, if you were to buy your nightmares, how much would they cost?
I do like that. I also like a crumb from
your
scone.
I don't remember
scone,
what the hell that was about.
What? The price of your nightmares?
Yeah.
Oh, it was the monitor of your dreams for the price of your nightmares.
Oh, yeah. I do like that a lot, actually.
That's pretty
that
good.
Very good.
Right,
that might be
that.
My new favorite.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah. All that right. Does not apply to the Neo, by the way, which hopefully people who listen to the show will realize. It is just applying to the monitors.
Cool.
All right, vamp for a second while I do
all
this.
All right. Thank you, live people. We will talk to you next week.